That's my understanding, yes, Jill.
Okay. All right, then we will go ahead and start. And are we ready? Okay, we are recording. Welcome to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, February 23rd, 2022. To our members of the public, we are pleased to offer video live streaming of this meeting, as well as a phone conference line for audio only. For access, go to our website at www.jeffersonhealthcare.org. Select About Us, then Hospital Commission, and scroll down to the links. This session is being officially audio recorded, and times shown on the agenda are estimate only. The virtual world meeting is being held under Governor Inslee's COVID-19 Notice of Proclamation 2028, so there is no live public comment period. However, our community members are welcome to comment on any item or concern via a letter addressed to the commissioners at 834 Sheridan Street, Port Townsend, 98368, or via email to commissioners@jeffersonhealthcare.org. Commissioner Reddy is excused. All other commissioners are present. So I now call for a move to approve today's agenda.
So move.
So move.
Okay, who wants a second? Bruce, I think you're second.
Okay.
Is there discussion? All in favor, raise your hand, please. Okay, thank you. It's official. So the agenda is approved. We will move now into governance discussion. So we had our February 16th board retreat. So commissioners, do you have any comments? What about the retreat impressed you? Did you have any aha moments? Is there a key takeaway you gained from our session? What would you like to say about our retreat? Who wants to go first? If you don't, then I'm going to pick somebody. All right, Bruce, you're at the upper left-hand corner.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed the retreat. It's always good to be involved with Karma because you always learn something, and she always has a lot of good information, and I think she certainly gave me some things to think about and questions to ask to get to, you know, what's really important, and the, you know, questions to ask about what questions to ask. So.
Right. Mari?
Well, yes, I think as usual, I think this is what our third or fourth session retreat with Karma, and you know, as is customary, she provided an excellent governance workshop, and I think as Bruce said, it thought-provoking and thinking outside the box to some degree, and also I think it just stimulates or enlivens the work that we're doing, or the thoughts about the work that we're trying to do. So I very much appreciate Karma. First time I saw her, I thought, of all the governance and seminars and workshops that I've had over the past, since I've been on the board, I think Karma by far exceeds expectations, and with delivery information and her ability to draw things out of all of us.
Case?
Well, I would agree with the comments that both Bruce and Mari made. I also believe that every time we have spent time with her, it's been well worthwhile. I think she really helped us understand how we're functioning as a board by reviewing our board evaluation questions for us, and I think she distilled those in a very helpful way. I think she did a good job of outlining governance issues, and I'll say this here: it's what I wrote in the evaluation. I also had a feeling that she presented perhaps more time than was required and didn't allow us quite as much time to have discussion amongst the five of us, which is what generative governance is all about. It's all about discussion, brainstorming. And I think we did some brainstorming. I forget when we had our own time to do generative thinking, but I would have liked to do a little more of that at this retreat. She stimulated me to go back and to look at the governance book that she shared, and I realized that we as a board have never actually really talked about anything in here. We've just sort of given our general impressions, but we're not really studying the book to see how can we do better at generative governance. And I was struck by, you know, this line on page 79 that says, nearly everyone in a nonprofit except the board uses generative thinking to influence the organization. And there's the section in here that talks about how good managers and the management team, they're using generative thinking all the time to try to come up with, to try to stay ahead of the curve. And so I would love to have us spend some more time, maybe the same way that the management, Mike's management team is doing a book club, a book study, where they're reading a book together and then talking about what they see in that can help them improve. So I'm still looking forward to trying to have us talk a little bit more about how we can do generative governance and try to keep up with management, really. So, yeah, that's all for now.
Well, I think you're going to get your wish next month. You can have a generative session scheduled in March. So that's going to be all about generative governance. So we'll have an ample opportunity there, I think. We were trying to cover so much as usual in our retreat. I think what I really get the most out of is after 4 years now, we have some data on how are we really improving and from our self-evaluations. And I really like comparing that. Seeing, you know, where do we feel that we're improving and where do we need to improve more? I think that's so very valuable. And the only way you can get that is just by, through times of, different meetings and things. So I think those are very, very valuable. And then all the above that you all mentioned too, she's a gem. I've never seen anybody that could diffuse a situation or bring people out or point out things that we're not aware of and make us feel good about it and feel productive. Mike, what do you have to, do you have any comments? You were part of our team too.
Thought it was a good retreat. I agree with everything said about Karma. I think the fact that we've worked with her for 4-ish years, and we have 4 data points of board evaluations and assessments is real helpful. So I thought it was like past years, a useful use of our time.
So great. So should we pursue this next year? Do you want to keep this up, do you think? Does it sound like something we want to keep doing? Yes. Case.
Yeah, I certainly think we do. I think we benefit a lot from it. And the continuity is extremely helpful. There is one thing that I would still like to get from the data of our board evaluation work, which is what does the data look like if we take out a consistent outlier? Mm-hmm. I'd like to know what the vast majority of the board, how we rate our board functioning, and not have it, you know, dragged down by an outlier. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if we could just get that. It should be pretty easy to get that data.
Yes, I think we can. So.
I agree with that. I think it would be interesting if we could get extract that from the data that we've already done. Thanks, Paige, for thinking of that.
We actually do have that, and I will send it out to make sure that all the commissioners.
Okay. Great.
So, all right. Well, then, is there any further comment?
Sure. I wonder if folks would be willing to go through and to have us discuss at least one chapter in the governance as leadership book, so that we can look at that and talk about that. And there are some fabulous sections in there about how you have to do it in concert with the CEO, and how it's got to be a team effort, and how it's not our working on generative thinking doesn't diminish Mike's need to do that as a manager, et cetera, et cetera. So there's really some good stuff in there that I think would be worth discussing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can attack that on in March at our governance special session. So if there's no further comment, it's time to move on to our next education session. So we'll go ahead and, as you know, we commissioners are required to periodically review the Open Public Meetings and Open Public Records Act. So today we have a recorded video from the Association of Washington Public Hospital Districts on Hot Topics from 2021. Brittany, thank you for putting this together, and let's watch. And then we will recess at 3:30. At 3:15, we will recess and come back at 3:30.
Please let me know if the audio is too loud or not loud enough.
I think it could be a little louder.
Good morning, and welcome to today's webinar, Open Public Meetings Act Hot Topics, a closer look at hospital district frequently asked questions. Before the presentation begins, I'd like to share a few housekeeping notes. To begin, everyone participating has been set to listen-only mode. If you have a question, please use the chat function in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. Now, as we expect the content to encompass the entire hour, we will do our best to respond to all questions via email after the end of the session. We are recording today's webinar, and a copy will be made available for future viewing. Today's session provides one credit hour towards the WSHA and AWPHD Healthcare Governance Certification or Recertification. Information on how to log your credit hour will be provided at the end of today's webinar. And now I'd like to introduce Matthew Ellsworth, Executive Director for the Association of Washington Public Hospital Districts.
Great. Thank you, Ryan. And thank you all for joining us today for one of our annual webinars that is also one of the biggest benefits to our members from the feedback that we get. Today, we're going to focus on those topics identified by you, the public hospital districts, regarding the Open Public Meeting Act. Our speakers today are from the Municipal Research and Services Center. You know them as MRSC, Oscar Ray and Flannery Collins. MRSC has been a longtime partner of AWPHD. They write the legal manual that all of you use as one of the best resources out there when it comes to PhD regulation. Oscar, who a lot of you know well, joined MRSC as a legal consultant in August of 2016 and has practiced municipal law since 1995, where he served as an assistant city attorney for the city of Kirkland. And his practice covers a wide range of municipal topics, including land use, public records, public works, many other areas of concern to PhDs in local government. At MRSC, Oscar provides AVW PhD members with inquiry and training services and develops and updates the online resources. And Oscar also teaches municipal law at Seattle University School of Law as adjunct faculty. Oscar is a lifelong resident of Washington and graduated from the University of Washington Law School. Thank you for joining us, Oscar. Flannery is the managing attorney for MRSC. She joined the organization as a legal consultant in August of 2013 after serving as the assistant attorney for the city of Shoreline, where she advised all city departments on a wide range of issues. At MRSC, Flannery manages a team of five legal consultants, conducts trainings on various municipal law issues, and provides legal guidance to cities, counties, special purpose districts on all municipal issues, including today's OPMA, the PRA, and personnel matters. And she also serves on the WSMA Board of Directors as Secretary Treasurer. Thank you both for joining us today, and we'll pass it over to you.
Good morning, everybody. This is Flannery. Thank you very much for the introductions. So I'll just give a really quick introduction to MRSC Services before we launch into our substance today. So we've served local governments in Washington State for 85 years. We are a group of policy and legal consultants, and we assist not only public hospital districts, but also other special purpose districts and cities and counties throughout the state. So we do have a one-on-one consultation service where you can ask a policy or a legal question via email or phone, and we'll research it and get back to you within your requested time. We also have excellent online resources, such as our website, and we have e-newsletters, timely blogs on issues of importance to municipalities, and trainings like the one we're doing today. So please check out our website and blog for more information, and feel free to contact us if you have any legal or policy questions that you would like researched. And with that, I'm going to pass it off to Oscar Ray, who is going to review today's agenda.
Thank you, Flannery. We came up with this agenda based on the types of inquiries that we received from public hospital districts. And so I went back and looked at what areas are we getting the most questions on. And so the topics that we've come up with for you today are serial meetings and what to do if you have a series of communications that result in a legal meeting and how do you avoid that. And then following on that, communications best practices, how do you structure your communications to avoid OPMA problems? And I'm going to talk through both those. And then Flannery is going to address executive session procedures and take a special look. There's a lot of reasons why you can go into executive session, but Flannery is going to focus on hiring and personnel matters and what can be discussed and what should not be discussed in executive session. Then she's going to talk about the resources we have for executive session on our website. And then finally, we're going to talk a little bit about legislation on the OPMA that's before the state legislature right now. And Matt's going to chime in with his thoughts on what the future might hold in addition to our summary of the legislation. So let's start with serial meetings. And let's just start by talking about what is a serial meeting. A serial meeting happens when you have a majority of members of a governing body. And so that for a public hospital district, that's going to be the board. And what happens if there's a series of smaller gatherings or communication that result in a majority of the body collectively taking action? Now, we have to remember that action is not just passing motions or adopting resolutions, it's deliberations and discussions. And so the word action is broadly defined for OPMA purposes. And a serial meeting happens even if a majority is never part of any one communication. And so you have to look at all the communications that occurred and decide, did it involve a majority? And was there a collective intent on the part of the governing body to meet? And if there was, then you have a problem as far as serial meetings are concerned. So this is actually an area in which there are several cases, and the cases and the facts that gave rise to them actually are helpful for drawing the boundaries and creating an understanding of what constitutes a serial meeting. So the first case I want to talk about is called Wood versus Battleground School District. And that case involved a 5-member school board, and 3 members were elected in an election, and all 3 of them had a desire to replace the superintendent. They weren't happy with the superintendent, and so one of their and I seem to have lost the ability to advance my slides. But anyway, I'll talk a little bit about Wood. Oh, here we go. So even before they took office, they started talking about what they were going to do to replace the superintendent. And some of those emails involved the 3 newly elected members, and then others involved the other 2 members who had already been serving on the board. And at one point, one of the established members of the board said, "I'm not really comfortable with these communications about what we're going to do about the superintendent. I think there might be an OPMA violation, and therefore I'm going to step out of these communications." And so that was probably enough to at least put the new folks on notice that they were potentially violating the OPMA, but they continued to have those communications, and the communications occurred both before they took the oath of office and afterwards. And so a lawsuit was brought saying that they violated the OPMA, and they submitted the 3 defendants, the 3 members who had been newly elected, submitted declarations saying, "Yeah, we didn't know we were violating the OPMA." Now, one thing to keep in mind is the Wood case was decided 20 years ago, and so our understanding of serial meetings has expanded a lot in the last 20 years. And certainly people still should have known what a serial meeting was prior to the back in 2001. But it's important to note that there was not a training requirement, and elected officials were not required back then to do the types of OPMA training that they're required now to do by statute. So the court ended up finding that that there was a potential serial meeting, that there was a potential violation of the OPMA, and this was a relatively simple case in the sense that it was just a group of elected officials exchanging emails. Okay, so our first question. Some of the communications in Wood occurred prior to taking the oath of office. Are those communications subject to the OPMA? And in the Wood case, the court said no. The court found they essentially drew a bright line and said the OPMA starts to apply once you have taken the oath of office and done all the things you need to do to assume office. What's interesting is that some courts in other states have actually taken the position that open public meetings requirements can take place even prior to taking office. But that's not the rule in Washington. But it is kind of a gray area in the sense of it's a close call in the sense that some courts have taken one position and other courts have gone the other way. Next question. Is an official's claim of lack of knowledge of an OPMA violation in a defense in an action to impose penalties? And I think the answer is that in the present day, saying that I don't know or I didn't understand what the requirements were is not a defense. And what we're going to find in the more subsequent cases that follow is that we're going to go away from what the personal knowledge is of whether an official was in violation or not. And it's really going to be more of a question about whether there was a collective intent to take action. And that doesn't necessarily mean that an individual needed to know that their actions were in violation of the OPMA. The next case I want to talk about is called Citizens Alliance, and as a Washington Supreme Court case decided in 2015, and it involved the critical areas ordinance that was adopted, that was being considered by San Juan County. And critical areas ordinances are always controversial, and they're especially controversial in places like San Juan County, where you have really valuable natural resources and wetlands and shorelines, and also people who want to develop their property. And so prior to adopting a critical areas ordinances, the county commissioners formed an advisory committee of stakeholders, which included a few of the commissioners, but less than a majority. And it also included other stakeholders who were interested in the issue. And they deliberated and discussed over a long time. It was a number of months, and there were a lot of communications. And then at one point, there is an email and a telephone exchange that included an additional commissioner, which made, when you looked at all of the communications together, which made a majority of the governing body. And that commissioner received communications but didn't respond. And the court, and so it's important to understand how this came up. The court found that there wasn't an OPMA violation, but the reason it came up was that citizens who didn't like the critical areas ordinance, once it was adopted by the council, brought an action claiming that the ordinance was adopted in violation of the OPMA and therefore sought to invalidate it. And so that's a really good example of some of the consequences that can happen if you do have OPMA problems. It can invalidate the action that was taken if it was taken in violation of the OPMA. But in this case, the court found no OPMA violation because the commissioners were not aware that the communications included a majority. And this idea that passive receipt of information is not action under the OPMA. So even though you have an additional commissioner which made a majority, the fact that that commissioner, who maybe was up on his OPMA training, that didn't create a violation because that commissioner didn't chime in and continue the deliberations or the discussions that were taking place. So the next question is, assume newly elected officials conducted a serial meeting after taking office, but prior to taking OPMA training. Have they violated the OPMA if they honestly believe they weren't acting unlawfully? And the answer is yes, because this Citizens Alliance case is the court's opportunity to clarify that we're not looking into what a subjective mental state is going on for a particular member. We're looking at whether there's a collective intent to meet. And so it's important to draw a distinction. And an official who does not know that his or her conduct violates the OPMA might not be liable for civil penalties. But that's different than the question about whether a series of communications or a serial meeting violates the OPMA. The next case I have is Seattle versus Caseburg, and that involves communications with your constituents if you're an elected official. And the Caseburg case clarifies that communications between individual council members and members of the broader community by themselves would not trigger serial meeting concerns. And so what was going on in Caseburg Caseburg involved a waterfront access area on Lake Washington that had been historically used by the public, but was later, through court action, shut down to public use. And so members of the public who wanted to reopen the waterfront area started a letter writing campaign to the Seattle City Council and lobbied all nine council members, asking that they use eminent domain to reopen that area as a park. And all nine members agreed at a council meeting to send a letter to the mayor requesting the commencement of eminent domain proceedings. And so the adjacent property owner who had shut down access to the area said, well, wait a second, you know, all nine of you just came to a public meeting and said, well, yeah, we want to send a letter to the mayor and ask that they start eminent domain proceedings. You must have been communicating and you must have pre-decided the issues because you just came out and said you were going to do that at a council meeting without warning. And there was no evidence that there was emails between the individual council members. And so the emails were between the individual council members and the public, their constituents who had an issue of public concern. And given the fact that that the communications went from constituents to the elected officials and not between elected officials, there was no evidence that there was communication outside an open public meeting. And the elected officials simply responded to the concerns that were raised by the constituents. So this next question gets us into what can happen sometimes when elected officials communicate with their constituents. A commissioner receives an email from a constituent who has a great idea for a district wellness campaign. The commissioner immediately forwards the email to all of the other commissioners seeking input and support. Does emailing a majority of the governing body constitute a serial meeting? And the answer is not yet. It's not a good practice for a commissioner to email directly all of the other commissioners on the governing body. But there is not a serial meeting until there is additional communication between the commissioners. And so if the commissioners do respond and hit reply all to continue the discussion, that's where you run into a problem of serial meetings. Okay, so the last case I have to talk about is Egan versus Seattle. This was quite recent. It was decided last September, and it involves the Seattle employee head tax. And it illustrates how complicated and a serial meeting analysis can get, especially if it's an issue involving a large number of council members on a issue that is of vital public concern. And so the court goes into painstaking detail to describe how over a 3-day period, there are over 25 communications and lots of different types of communicating, text messages, emails, phones, in-person meetings, about the employee head tax that Seattle had adopted in 2018. And one additional fact that was interesting was a staff member of one of the council members actually prepared a vote tally sheet ahead of time and had tallied which council members he or she thought were going to vote to repeal. So at this point, it's probably a good idea to talk about the symbiotic relationship between the OPMA and the Public Records Act, because obviously when a decision to repeal the head tax is made and is announced without much in the way of warning at a council meeting, people get suspicious and open government advocates may say, well, I wonder how that happened. I want all the emails, I want all the texts, I want all the communications between all the council members and their staff members and the mayor's office prior to leading up to that vote. And so obviously, that's what happened here, and you can tell just by the detail of the information that the parties were able to produce to the court in expressing their concerns about a serial meeting. Now, the court found insufficient evidence of a serial meeting until the press release, and the press release said, "We heard you. It's time to hit reset. This week, instead of prolonging a fight, we are moving forward with legislation to repeal the current tax on large businesses to address the homelessness crisis." That's what the final press release said, but there was a draft of the final press release that was changed about 15 minutes prior to the release being issued, and it included the language, "This bill has the support of a majority of the city council." And it appears that that language was removed shortly before the release on advice of legal counsel. And that language and that underscored language is what made the court say, well, we think there's an issue here, and we think there's a material issue of fact as to whether there is a serial meeting or not. So in Egan, the trial court had found that there wasn't a serial meeting. The Washington Supreme Court, the Washington Court of Appeals remanded. And so a question, under Egan, does it violate the OPMA for a quorum of a governing body to communicate with each other in advance of a public meeting on how they intend to vote on a particular item? And the court says, basically, yes, if the council collectively commits or promises each other to vote as a group in favor or in opposition to a piece of pending legislation. One of the interesting things about Egan, in my view, is that it really kind of illustrates how the rules are different at the local level than they are at the state and federal level. And so if you go to the state legislature or if you go to Congress, there are people there who will brag about their ability to quote to count votes. And the OPMA is just an acknowledgement that there are different rules in place for local governments. And in local governments, you don't get to talk ahead of time about counting votes. And it's the policy in favor of transparency that precludes governing bodies from doing that. And I think one of the areas where I think the OPMA asks local elected officials to sort of act against their initial impulses. I think it's human nature to say, oh, I wonder how my fellow commissioners are going to vote on this topic. Or, I wonder how this is going to play out. I want to have a really well-organized meeting, and so I want to know and have it all scripted out ahead of time. And under the OPMA, you have to resist your impulse to want to script your meetings or talk to your commissioners ahead of time if it may result in serial meetings. So my last question, if a majority of the governing body has pre-decided how it will vote, is that a violation of the OPMA? And it's not the pre-deciding that's the problem under Egan. You, as an elected official, may know how you're going to vote on a legislative matter before it comes to you at a meeting, and pre-deciding itself is not the issue. It's the fact that there are communications about and agreements about how votes will be taken that can create the issue if that happens between a quorum of the governing body. So that's serial meetings. And now I'm just gonna talk briefly about communication best practices. And I just have several hints for avoiding serial meeting and best practices. Structure your district communications to channel communications to the board through a single point of contact. And that's somebody who's not elected. So that can be your CEO or superintendent, or it can be an executive assistant. staff should send communications individually to each member of a governing body instead of including all of them in one communication. That will resist the or prevent the impulse to do a reply all. Train frequently and remind your commissioners, or commissioners should remind themselves to direct communications to a staff point of contact instead of fellow commissioners. And finally, maintain appearances. And I think this is a big one. Communications between commissioners, even if they don't relate to district businesses, don't necessarily violate the OPMA, but they can create mistrust on the part of the public. And so if you're at a meeting prior to the meeting starting and you're talking with your commissioners and the public can't hear what you're saying, sometimes people will take that the wrong way. And it doesn't mean you can't have those conversations, but it means you should be mindful about putting yourself in situations where it may appear that you're talking about district business when you really aren't. Another hint, and this is something that is available on our website, we have MRSC practice tips. We have a series of them on the OPMA, and we have one for electronic communications. And you can see here, it contains a lot of good meetings, a lot of good information, and it contains, an email exchange can constitute a meeting. And so you'll see in these practice tips a lot of recommendations and best practices that you can follow. Train frequently, and you don't just have to train about the OPMA, and obviously we as lawyers are always trying to train you about how to stay out of trouble, but we also at MRSC offer training for how to conduct great online meetings. And so you can see here next Thursday we have a webinar for facilitating great online meetings, and our offerings include more than just how to stay out of trouble. And then finally, Ask MRSC, and obviously, hopefully you're familiar with our Ask MRSC function, but if you're an elected official or an employee of an AWPHD member, then under our contract with AWPHD, you can go to our research tools and click Ask MRSC and submit the questions that you need answer to on the OPMA and anything else relating to general governance issues for your district. And with that, I will pass it over to Flannery, and she will talk to you about executive session procedures.
Okay, thanks, Oscar. Okay, so as Oscar indicated, we're going to look now at executive sessions. So the first thing is, what are they? What are executive sessions? They are considered part of the legislative body's public meeting, but they're the only part where members of the public are excluded. So to go into an executive session, the legislative body will leave the public meeting room and go into a separate conference room or a virtual room in order to hold the executive session in private. There are statutorily defined reasons for holding an executive session of the board, all of which can be found in RCW 4230.110. There are a couple exceptions for public hospital districts, which I'll go over later, that are not found in 4230.110, but separately in a different statute, but we'll talk about that in a couple slides. So legislative bodies cannot meet in executive session for basically anything they want to talk about. They have to have the executive session topic fit under one of those that are outlined in the statute. So we should think of these executive sessions as an exception to the OPMA's requirement for open public meetings. And there are several important things to keep in mind regarding executive sessions. The first is that formal votes should not be taken in executive session. And the second is that the substance of executive session discussions is confidential. So in other words, attendees at the executive session should not be sharing the discussion with citizens or uninvolved staff. Okay, So the next series of slides here, I'm going to go over a few, several common topics used by legislative bodies for executive sessions. And the first one I'm discussing is consideration of real estate matters. This is the public agency's discussion about purchase, lease, and sale of real property. And the critical factor here that must be met is that public knowledge of the discussion must be likely to either increase or decrease the price of the property, whichever the case may be. There's a relatively recent case on the exception allowing for consideration of the minimum sale price for real estate. And the case really limited the exception to just the discussion of the minimum acceptable value to sell or lease property, and does not allow discussion of all the factors that comprise the value. So we have a pretty comprehensive blog post on this topic if you're interested in learning more. So just go to MRSC Insight blog and search for executive sessions real estate, and it should come up. Okay, another common executive session topic are confidential discussions with agency legal counsel, and those can be on an enforcement action, current or potential litigation, or legal risks of current or proposed action. So all of these require attendance and participation by the agency legal counsel. So this can either be the regular district counsel or one hired specifically to represent the district in litigation. The statute goes into some detail with regard to what is considered potential litigation. So your legal counsel would need to take a closer look at that language to ensure that the executive session falls within the parameters of the statute. Discussion of personnel matters is also a common executive session topic. I'm going to cover this in a bit more detail later in the presentation. So for now, I'll just say the important thing to keep in mind is that the statute is really more nuanced than just allowing the governing body to discuss any personnel issue. Instead, as you can see on the slide here, it limits discussion to qualifications of an applicant for public employment or appointment of an official to a vacant position. Two, it allows discussions about an employee's performance. Or three, it allows the board to receive and evaluate complaints against an employee or official. So I'll go into that a bit more after the next couple of slides here, where I'm going to talk about procedural steps that must be taken. So the first thing about procedural thing to keep in mind is that executive sessions can occur either during a regular meeting or a special meeting. And sometimes agencies will hold a special meeting just to have an executive session, and this is permitted. For the public announcement, this is at the meeting. The chair would verbally state the purpose for holding the executive session and the time of adjournment of the executive session. And it's recommended here to cite the actual RCW and then to repeat the language that appears in the RCW. I mean, you can summarize it, but you should try to repeat some of the language so that the public understands why the board is going into executive session. So really, the announcement should have enough detail to identify the purpose that's falling within the parameters of the law. So the verbal announcement is really the only notice the public gets about the executive session, because first of all, minutes are not required and also not recommended for executive sessions just because of their confidential nature. And also, the executive session really doesn't have to appear on a preliminary agenda for the regular meeting. It may be good practice to include it on the preliminary agenda, but it doesn't have to be. It can be added to the agenda during the meeting. And to do this, a commissioner would just make a motion to add an executive session to the agenda for one of the topics outlined in the statute. And with regard to special meeting notice, the only requirement there is that the notice identify the business to be transacted. So if the board knows in advance that an executive session will be required during the special meeting, it should note that in the notice. But if the need for an executive session actually arises during the meeting, it can be held so long as it falls within the business to be transacted topic that was identified on the notice. So what happens if an executive session ends early? So I indicated earlier that there's two things you have to say when you verbally announce the executive session, what the topic is to be discussed and the time of adjournment of the executive session. So here, what if you've said, the chair says, we're going to go into executive session until 6 o'clock, but you finish early. Let's say you finish at 5:45. Well, you actually do need to wait to reconvene. Because the public, if you reconvene at 5:45 and the public doesn't come back until 6, then basically you've effectively excluded the public from a portion of the open meeting because some may not return until the 6 o'clock p.m. Time that was originally announced. So just wait if you finish early. That's the insight there. So what if you end late? So if it's running long, what you should do prior to the time that you've indicated the executive session will adjourn, so here at 6 p.m., the presiding officer would go back to the public meeting room and announce that the executive session will be extended to a later time, and then announce what that time is. So often this is done, at least in normal times, non-pandemic times, this announcement can be done to an empty room. Nonetheless, it's a procedural step that must be taken. So just go back to the meeting room and say we're extending until 7 p.m., for example. So what about attendance at executive sessions? Well, clearly the board will be there, but others can be there as well, and this would include both staff and non-staff. They would have to have a reason to be there. For example, are they presenting on the topic, or are they the project manager for a project that's going to be discussed for whatever reason? So the other thing to note is that legal counsel must be there. So we discussed that earlier. This would be required only when the discussion involves litigation or agency enforcement actions. Otherwise, legal counsel is not required to be there. Okay, so here's the deeper dive related to personnel that I talked about earlier. So the question is, let's say you need to go into executive session to discuss an employee. Is that allowed? And the answer is yes, so long as you're doing one of the three things on the slide here, which would be discussing qualifications of an applicant for employment, you're discussing the performance of a current employee, or you're evaluating a complaint that was brought against a current employee. And one thing that MRSC, a question we get really frequently is, can we just say we're going into executive session to discuss personnel? And that's really too vague for your notice. You'd want to cite the RCW and then cite one of these specific reasons. Okay, so I'm going to look at these personnel topics one by one. So the first personnel topic a governing body may discuss in executive session is evaluation of qualifications of an applicant for public employment or for appointment of an elected official to a vacant position. So for applicants for employment positions, this can include interviews. This can be done in executive session. However, I should have an asterisk there on this slide for the interviews portion, because for applicants for appointed positions for elected office, so these would be if there's a vacancy and the board is discussing who should fill that vacancy on the board, that those interviews must be done in open session. But for both types of applicants, whether to the governing body or for employment, the governing body can discuss qualifications of that individual. They can discuss salary wages of the applicant that they as an individual may be qualified to receive. And then of course the executive session discussion cannot involve an actual vote to select the individual to fill the vacant position or to be hired. That would have to occur in open session. So the next executive session topic that can be discussed related to personnel is performance of an employee. So governing bodies can use this provision, for example, when considering a promotion or a salary increase for a specific employee or for disciplinary matters based on a specific employee's performance. However, as I indicated earlier, any action, like actually voting on a salary increase or taking disciplinary action, has to be done in open session. So this may not be used too often, given that personnel matters are within the purview of the superintendent or the CEO, but it could be used for discussion of the CEO or superintendent's performance. Okay, the final personnel topic that can be discussed is receipt or evaluation and evaluation of complaints or charges brought against an officer or employee. So the executive session topic allows for discussion of really any complaint. It doesn't need to be an extremely formal complaint like a lawsuit, but there does need to be some complaint or charge brought against the person. It can be a charge or complaint brought by another agency employee or official, or it can be brought by someone outside the agency. And interestingly enough, the statute indicates that at the option of the quote unquote accused employee or official, they can choose to have that complaint or charge be heard in open session rather than executive session. That's at their option. Okay, a few more slides here on executive session. Collective bargaining. I did want to mention this one anomaly regarding excluding the public from board discussions. So that would be a collective bargaining. These are actually outside the OPMA. They're not executive session discussions. They're what are referred to as closed sessions regarding collective bargaining negotiations. So what this means is that the board can meet without public notice to plan or adopt a strategy or position to be taken during collective bargaining, professional negotiations, et cetera. They can meet to review proposals made in the negotiations or proceedings. They can conduct the collective bargaining negotiation sessions in a closed meeting. So it's pretty, it's different from executive sessions, and it can be outside the public eye. And one of the statute unique to public hospital districts for an executive session topic is 7044062. And that is where the board can meet in executive session to discuss the status of clinical or staff privileges of a physician or other healthcare provider, any final board action regarding denial, revocation, or restriction of clinical or staff privileges must be done in open session, but they can meet to discuss the status in executive session. The board can also meet in executive session to review reports or activities of the Quality Improvement Committee, but any final action on the report must be done in open session. Okay, I'm just gonna breeze through these next couple of slides pretty quickly given time. So MRSC, as you've heard us say several times, has a wealth of resources on our website regarding any municipal topic, but with regard to executive sessions, we have a checklist, which you can find on the OPMA page. And this checklist is basically a cheat sheet on must-dos for an executive session. It goes through everything procedurally you need to do and also highlights common reasons for retiring into executive session. We have a sample script that you can use or modify for your own purposes, where it indicates kind of what you should say verbally before going into executive session. And we have blogs. I've indicated earlier our blogs. We really are very focused in topics we select to write our blogs on. We have a lot that are just on seminal issues like executive sessions 101 you'll see here, or we do emerging issues like, for example, the new proclamation and where public meetings stand under the new proclamation. So check out our blogs for a lot of executive session and OPMA information. Finally, we just this past year, I guess 2020, we now have OPMA FAQs, and you'll see here there's a number about executive sessions on our website. So now I'll pass it back to Oscar for the legislative update.
Thank you, Flannery. Just a few thoughts on the bills before the legislature. And I think I'm going to say a couple of words real quick, and then Matt's going to jump in with his thoughts. But there are three bills before the legislature. HB 1180 did not make it out of committee. I have a quick summary here that I'm just going to provide you. And the reason I'm providing it is that it's possible that with some of the other bills, some elements of HB 1180 could get incorporated into the other legislation through the amendment process. But at this point, HB 1180 is dead. The thing that is sort of interesting to me about the OPMA legislation, proposed legislation before the legislature, is that I had thought that there might be a move to make to give local governments a little bit more flexibility in terms of during non-emergency times, non-COVID-19 times, that they might have more flexibility to meet remotely or in person or some combination of the two. And none of the legislation really seems to address that. One thing that is addressed in all of the legislation is the possibility of requiring public comment. And that struck me as interesting as well, because my perception is that most agencies provide public comment because that's what their constituents want. And so prior to this session, I would have thought, well, I don't think that's really a problem, but apparently it is a priority for the legislature. So then the next bill that I'll touch on is 1329, which is currently in the House of Representatives, and it encourages agencies to allow public comment and use technology to increase public participation. It also encourages agencies to record their meetings and provide online streaming options and retain the recordings available for at least 6 months. It requires agencies to enter into their meeting minutes the announced purpose for going into an executive session. I think that's a fairly standard practice already, but it would codify that. It would require agencies to provide an opportunity for public comment at all regular meetings, either orally at the meeting or in writing submitted beforehand. And then finally, if an agency does allow oral comments, the agency must also provide a remote comment option to any individual for whom it would be difficult to physically attend the meeting. So somebody who may be mobility impaired, but it could be other reasons as well. So that is still in the House, has not been passed by the House or gone to the Senate yet. But the one that is probably the furthest along in the process is ESHB 1056. It has already been passed unanimously by the House and is currently before the Senate. And it really focuses on emergency situations, and it would give agencies greater flexibility to hold remote meetings if you have a declared emergency. So you wouldn't necessarily have to have all of the emergency proclamations that the governor has issued, because all of that would be codified in the OPMA if this legislation passes. It would allow remote meetings. It would allow a governing body to meet in person, but limit attendance of the public, provided that there's a remote option for the public to hear what's going on. And it provides that no action could be taken if remote public access is not provided during the emergency. Finally, it talks about how the situations under which agencies must have a website. And the OPMA requires that agendas be posted on an agency website if the agency has 10 or more full-time equivalent employees. And this legislation changes those requirements. It's a little bit complicated. There's kind of a long list of criteria, but the legislature is clearly trying to expand the scope of agencies that both have websites and use their websites to provide OPMA notices to the public. And so one of the options, if an agency doesn't have a website, is to it could combine or team with another agency that does have a website to provide those services. And if your agency doesn't have a website and you're interested in whether it meets the criteria listed in the statute, do let us know. And that's probably one where it's going to be easier to just one-on-one walk through the legislation, see what the requirements say, and make a call in terms of whether you're actually required to do that or not. This is really an issue for some of the very small special purpose districts and towns that are out there. I don't know that it's as much of an issue for public hospital districts. And so with that, I will hand it over to Matt, who is going to provide some of his thoughts on what's going on at the legislature for hospital districts. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Oscar. And Flannery, appreciate that. Before we conclude, I just wanted to offer a little bit of insight on those pieces of legislation that would affect how we conduct business and virtually. These are priorities of AWPHD. The AWPHD Board of Trustees has set this as one of our top things to fix. Now, one of the frustrations that these are going after is that, as many of you are probably aware, during the declared emergencies, we went through what I would call a lot of leapfrog proclamations coming from the governor's office. So what we set out to do was to set a new system so we could avoid that and create some automatic triggers. One of the things I'd point out when Oscar said that during times of declared emergencies, one of the benefits that we've put into that legislation is that that declared emergency can be on the county level. So if you have, say, wildfire happening in your district and that's preventing transportation needs or communication needs or what have you, and your county declares an emergency, you can move to that virtual option. At the end of the day, we remain committed to the transparency that occurs under the business that we do under OPMA and within the districts. And so this is another tool that we're looking to put out there. As Oscar pointed out, there are some new requirements within the virtual meetings to allow a little more touch points for public participation. But at the end of the day, that's a good thing. And we have found that the virtual meeting process over this past year has increased public participation, which, again, is a good thing. And has also created a lot of flexibility and input for folks that normally couldn't have traveled or for whatever reason not participated personally in a meeting. So I do believe that one of those two bills is going to make it to the governor's desk. Couldn't tell you which one right now. That we're going to go through some legislative processes that, you know, may create some amendments, some mashing of the two. But at the end of the day, I think we're going to leave this legislative session with some final resolution to that issue. With that, a few last notes while we close, and before I offer those, I want to offer an opportunity that I know a lot of you have some questions and an opportunity for you to send those in, and we'll make sure that those get answered. This webinar today is also going to be available for folks. And I know already of some boards that are going to go back and watch this recording as part of one of their upcoming board meetings. So thank you for attending. Another reminder for those who are working towards earning their WSHA and AWPHD healthcare certification, recertification, this qualifies for 1 credit hour. You'll be sent an email to the account that you use to register for this course. That email will provide you with instructions on how to log your credit hours. If there are multiple board members who have registered under one account, please have each individual follow the link provided in the email to ensure that everyone will be credited for their participation. If you have any further questions or would like to provide feedback on the course, feel free to email us at govedu@wsha.org. Again, govedu@wsha.org. Thank you for attending this course, and I want you to have a great day today. Use that email address to any follow-up questions or discussion you would like to have. We'll make sure that we get those to Flannery and Oscar, and we'll get an answer to you. So once again, thank you all for attending, and just have a wonderful day today.
Okay. Thank you, Brittany, for handling that. And it looks like I'm not sure what happened to the legislation since that was a year ago yesterday that was put out. But I looked up the last one, 1056, on while he was talking about it, and it looked like it came back this year. It's now in the Rules Committee. So I don't know how long it's going to be really necessary, because we'll be going back to in-person meetings pretty soon, I imagine. But we can follow up on that if anybody would like to have an update. And it looks like there's, as we know, there are a lot of really good resources on that website, on the MRSC, so we can avail ourselves of it. Are there any comments about from the board about the information contained therein? Yep. Mari, you had your hand up first.
I just think it's always good to have a refresher on these things to make sure we are doing what we're supposed to be doing and following these, the legal requirements. So it's always good.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Could you remind me again, are we trying to figure out how to get public comment to be part of our virtual meetings? Is that something we're exploring?
We've offered every time we meet, I mention how they can get public comments to us.
But sure, but that's
at this
not
point,
the...
we don't have. We just started live streaming today, mm-hmm. and so we haven't had that opportunity available to us. And I think what we need to do is decide when we can start meeting in person again, and then that may be a whole different scenario too. So, but yes, we will certainly invite the public to live comments as soon as we are able.
So that's not, you say when we are going to live streaming today. So at our next meeting, at our next virtual meeting, will the public be able to patch in and make a comment?
We will find out if that's available on our Microsoft Teams platform. So Bruce, you had a comment?
Yeah, I know that you always say that they can submit, written comments, but we've never read any. So am I to assume then that we've never received any?
We've never, to my knowledge, we haven't.
Okay.
Well, we've received some email questions to which you responded, Jill, and I think you sent your response to people. So we continue to get occasional emails, which is in essence a public comment.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not during a meeting.
No, not during the meeting, but
if someone wanted us to comment, wanted to bring a comment before the entire board, they're obviously welcome to do that. We encourage it, and we do see the responses at the board.
But how is that different than the latest email you got from Ryan at the Leader about access and all of that? I mean, wasn't that in essence a public comment, and that came to all of us on the board. Did Bruce not get that copy?
You'd have to ask Bruce.
I got it.
No. Okay.
I think what
are you leaving me out because I got it too.
Frequently happens or infrequently happens is if before we went to virtual meetings and after is typically someone calls Alyssa and asks about the logistics of the meeting for the purpose of sharing a comment. And prior to going virtual, Alyssa would, you know, tell them when the meeting starts and when the comment period is and help them with that. Now that we're virtual, what Alyssa will do, well, you can provide public comment, but it needs to be in letter form and encourages them to put their comment, which I think there is a distinction between a comment at a meeting versus a letter to the board, less so now because they're both of the same form. But that's typically what Alyssa does, and it just hasn't resulted in any public comments in written form. And you know, it's kind of a clunky way to do it. So I think we're all looking forward, and hopefully aren't that far away from in-person meetings again.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mike. Bruce.
Yeah, the question I would have is, you know, if we were having in-person meetings and somebody made a public comment, then everybody that's in the meeting or listening on the phone or is there hears that comment. If we get it in a letter and we don't read it at the meeting, then is it really a public comment?
Yes, no. And, you know, whether, I guess the thing would be for them to put, I'd like this, you know, this is a, consider this a public comment. Otherwise, you assume that it's a letter. If they don't state it's, you know, to the, that it would, they would like it read during the meeting.
Right.
All right, then we will go now on to our break, and we will reconvene at 3:30. Thank you, everyone. See you then. Good afternoon, and welcome back to the business portion of the February 23rd, 2022 Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting. And we will begin with a patient story from Tina Toner, our chief nursing officer.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm really excited to share a letter with you today that we received that illustrates, you know, every once in a while we get a letter that just kind of captures that journey that patients make throughout our entire organization. And then to think about how great that experience was for them all along the way. And so I'm really excited to share this one with you. Okay, so every employee that I encountered, from cleaning staff to specialists, was amazing. Dr. Parker in the emergency department listened carefully to my concerns and history, treating me as a whole person rather than a symptom. Dr. Hoffner reached out to the oncology department overnight so the right tests would be done first thing in the morning. Both delivered very bad news with empathy and kindness. Dr. Mendez kept me well informed throughout my stay and worked with Dr. Jafari and Dr. Norman to get me into the hands of a surgeon at Swedish who could extract the needed tissues for biopsy when they decided that was necessary. All of them encouraged me to ask questions and answered them in a way I could understand without talking down to me. The third floor nurses and staff were unfailingly kind, friendly, and generous. They were always quick to respond when called, and they never left the room without asking at least twice if they could get me or my partner anything. They made me feel like I was their only patient. Every technician I encountered, I think I know them all now, put me at ease and was happy to explain what they were doing. Cody, who did my echocardiogram, made the experience pleasant, and he clearly enjoys his work. I've been through your CT scanner at least 3 times now, and the folks down there are always great, always putting me at ease and telling me what to expect. I wish I remembered all their names. Everyone was awesome.
That's lovely. That's great. Well done.
We hope that the patient proceeds to recover and have some recovery, and we've been able to help her.
Absolutely. To be there kind of at such a difficult time in their lives, mm-hmm. and just to see everyone that helped them along their way is really awesome.
That's great. Mm-hmm. And hats off to our staff for doing that. You're wonderful. Okay, then, Case, I'm sorry I short-stopped you there, and I think that you wanted to read. Did you want to read the acknowledgement? You're muted.
I'd be happy to. Thank you. We acknowledge that Jefferson Healthcare is on the ancestral and contemporary homelands of the Tsklallam, Chimicum, Tswana, and other Indigenous nations, and we recognize the tribal government's sovereignty across the region.
Thank you. Okay, then we will move on to the minutes of the January 19th special session and the January 26th regular session minutes. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
So moved.
Okay. Mari motions and Bruce seconds. Is there discussion? All in favor, raise your hand, please. Of passing? Okay, it's unanimous. Then required approvals. Is there anything a commissioner would like to discuss separately within the required approvals? Then may I have a motion to approve, please?
So move.
Is there a second?
Second.
Mari and Bruce, and any further discussion? Okay, everyone in favor of approving the required approvals, raise your hand, please. Okay, it's unanimous. So then we will move to the Energy Star report by our facilities director, Chris O'Higgins. Chris, welcome.
Thank you. I wanted just to update everyone. I know I talked about this once before, and we've been working pretty diligently on this. So if you remember back when we did this in 19, we talked about the new House Bill 1257 going into effect. And it made me nervous only because of the building structure, which you're all aware of from, 65 all the way up to 2017. But we've made some pretty significant progress, and I wanted to be able to share this with the board and some great news. Next slide, Brittany. So per the House Bill 1227, we have to comply because we are over 90,000 square foot. We had to comply by 2027. So that kind of kickstarted this whole process as far as identifying and adding into Energy Star all of our information. So part of the resume now is energy manager for Jefferson Healthcare. It's been interesting. It's been a ride, and it's been really good news to be able to do this. It opens your eyes up to a few things that you're never too old to learn something new, and my crew has definitely taught me that. So. Next slide. This is why Governor Inslee put this into effect. There's a lot of complaints about this law because it is going to cost a lot of people some money to comply with it. But as you can see from the graphs, buildings are 51% of our greenhouse gases. And so to become sustainable, it's going to take a lot. It's going to take a lot of energy, a lot of time. It's not a short task in being the energy manager for a facility, as I'm beginning to learn quickly. But it's rewarding work if it's done right. And so this is where it's at, and this is why we did it. Next slide. I had told this board once before that I wanted to become Energy Star certified within 2 years. So in 2023 is when my goal was to become certified. And why do we want to do that? Because we want to be a top performing building. It's great to be able to boast that. You're saving 50 cents less per square foot than your peers. You generate 35% less greenhouse gases. I mean, these are all the reasons. These are good reasons why we're fighting this now to become compliant. And, you know, without a doubt, the master site plan is going to be a huge part of this, as we know. But it can also even make it better for us to do this because it means newer equipment, more energy efficient equipment. So this is why we're doing, this is why I'm doing it. This is why Jefferson Healthcare should be doing it. And so this is, you know, what the goal is so far. Next slide. Well, we're there. So if you can see, we're rated 97 out of the top 100.
Wow.
And if that's not an accomplishment, I don't want to get too excited here, but, you know, for a guy that gets to do this on a day-to-day basis, this makes me pretty excited. You know, I've been here 6 years, going on 6 years, which is amazing to me that I've been here that long. But I've been able to purchase and install very large Energy Star equipment, and that's thanks to Mike Glenn, all of SLG, from the CFO on up to the board. You know, you have to approve those capital projects. We are just finishing up the entire hospital on an LED retrofit. And a lot of this work comes back from PUD in forms of rebates. So like when we changed out all the sodium fixtures out on the waterside parking lot, I think it ran us right around $9,000 to change out those lights. PUD gave us a $6,000 check back. And so our electrician, James Dunn, and I got to give Jimmy some credit on this. Every time we change something now, he goes back to PUD and says, give me some money. And they're doing it. So that's a good thing. The master site project is going to, we're going to have to continue that because I'm going to try to figure out where that other 3% is. So as of today, we sit 97 out of 100. And that's amazing. So thank you. And I have applied. I've already submitted our application to be certified, which means we get a cool plaque for our doors and we can boast about it. So, you know, I just wanted to be able to tell this board that it didn't take me 2 years. It only took me a year to get there. And that's because of you guys and Mike Glenn, your guys' vision and trying to be sustainable and, you know, being allowing me to put in the equipment that I've put in since I've been here. One more slide. Oh, yeah, I got to get that in there. And that's the crew. You know, and I boast about these guys a lot, but every one of them thinks outside the box. You know, I'm Sean Muck now, who is the second from the right. He is now my lead in facilities and has taken this role and is running with it. Jimmy D, the guy that's standing right next to me there in a gray sweatshirt, he's their electrician. And, you know, Leslie kind of trained him up before Leslie retired. But, you know, these are the guys that helped me get to they're the ones that actually do the work. I just kind of sit here. But I want to appreciate them as well. So that's all I have. I just wanted to tell you is that the good news is that I've submitted the application for certification, and we're probably the only hospital on the peninsula that's going to reach a 97. At least that's what my hope is. Any questions?
Well done.
Thank you.
97, that's fabulous.
Now it's an accomplishment, and I can tell you I've worked in a couple of hospitals, and it's not easy to get these scores. But just the fact that you know, again, and I give credit to SLG because they're the ones that have to put up with me asking for all those fancy air handlers. Mike loves them, I know he does. But you know, we strive hard to you know, only put it, we have to now by law only put in things that are Energy Star certified, right? That's the new bill makes that a mandatory, but we've been doing it for at least the last 6 years that I'm aware of, because that's how long I've been here. And I'm looking forward to the next six. So I appreciate you guys. I appreciate your time, and thanks for letting me boast a little bit.
Oh, thank you. Mari, you had your hand up.
Could I go back to the slide, Brittany, where it shows the different amounts of the previous one to that, I think. No, okay, the one following, sorry. Next one. there was a slide that showed the go back to the picture one if you could, of the buildings. And so what constitutes the building is 27%. So what is that, Chris? Is it sort of not having insulation or gaps in the walls, or what are the things that make up that 27%
drives that?
Yeah,
I've been on, I can't even tell you how many webinars I've been on now with this new law going into place. The school districts are going to struggle because they fight this. It's everything from their windows to insulation. 90% of it is their equipment. You gotta imagine, we've got air handlers up on this roof that are over 20 years old. They are not energy efficient. By no means. I've been approved to install two more new ones this year. And both of those are coming back with PUD rebates. So that's going to help offset some of the cost of it. And that may end up driving us that extra 3%. I mean, my goal now is not to be Energy Star certified, it's to be 100%. But that is what they're fighting, between window panes, insulation, 90% of it comes from their equipment and lighting. Lighting is a huge part. And because we don't have natural gas on the peninsula, we're all electric. It makes it a little easier for us to fight this, because that's all I report on is electric and fuel. But it's still a huge accomplishment. But that's why. I held off from, I sit on the CAC meeting with Keith, and I held off on even telling him this at our last meeting, because I wanted the board to know before I announced it to the public. We haven't been sitting still. We've been diligently working at this.
No, it's absolutely fabulous. So waste is 3%. So we're recycling more, I assume.
We struggle with recycling on the peninsula because they don't recycle. I mean, they'll pick up certain things here, but cardboard is pretty much the amount of it. I wish they had a better recycling plan on the peninsula. I actually just found somebody to recycle styrofoam again. We had somebody for 2 years, and I just found someone out of Port Angeles that is going to start that up again for us next week, because we do throw away an awful lot of styrofoam. But as far as it's water. That's going to be my next focus, is what can we do to help control some of the water usage we use? Because between fuel is our number one, electric, and then water. And so water is going to be the next one that I'm going to go address, and with different areas and different pumps. And so that's where we're going next.
Great. That's absolutely great. Thanks very much, Chris. A tremendous job to the whole crew.
Yeah, appreciate that. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'd certainly like to second what Mari said. I mean, this is really amazing. I mean, it's so difficult to have the buildings that we have, the different types of buildings, the sizes of the buildings, the different elements and equipment, the uses. I mean, this is monumental to be able to keep a handle on energy efficiency for this. One question that I had is, do we have any data on how other hospitals rate? I mean, you said we'd be the only one on the peninsula, but is there somebody who can tell us, hey, what about other hospitals in Washington State?
Yes, and to answer that question, I also joined a coalition for rural healthcare clinics throughout the state of Washington, and they're going to be sharing their data with us because they didn't have anybody out this far. And so I opted on raising my hand, which I do a lot, say, I'll do it for you. And so they're the ones that I'll be able to get this information from them, because this is what they're in. It's Energy to Care. It's through ASHI. And they asked me if I would be part of their coalition, and I said, absolutely, we will, because, it's a proud moment for me, and it should be a proud moment for this hospital to be able to boast. And I'm not a quiet guy, so I like bragging about us.
What kind of score do you need in order to be certified? I mean, we're 97 out of 100.
You need a score of 75.
Whoa.
You can't even apply unless you're at least 75.
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
And when we first started this, I've got my chart up right now. When we first started this, we were at 74. And that was in 2019. And just from 2019 to 2020, because my last data input was in December of 2020, we are 7% difference in cost, minus 7%. We've saved that in energy cost in wow. just 2 years. So
that's significant.
That's you know, huge. Yeah, that's a big dollar amount.
I would love if at some point Tyler or somebody could tell us what the actual dollar value is of that. I mean, that would be fantastic. Show that. Yeah.
Yeah, I can show that in my next rollout to you. I've got it in data and energy portfolio. Right. What you have to put, all this in energy portfolio, and the government now has access to our site. At least the state of Washington has access to our site, so they know that we're in compliance. So it is available, and I will be able to report back out on that. I'll Good. Give it to you per year.
Well, Good. Thank you. Thanks. On behalf of the whole entire community and Jefferson Healthcare, of course, congratulations and thank you to you and your group. Yeah. It's amazing.
We appreciate it. Thank you, guys. Really
Absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's great work, and truly it's an example of getting efficient slowly but surely. I mean, Chris went to work on this 6 years ago, and I think due to a lot of reasons, just an antiquated plant, an underinvestment in infrastructure, kind of all of those things. His first assessment probably was, holy smokes, millions of dollars of improvements that all could be justified tomorrow. And he probably did. And we probably said, no, put a plan together, Chris, and we'll take this in bites and chunks. And that's what we did. I mean, it's like every budget cycle, you can count on two things. One, Aaron Stark's going to ask for this really cool new kitchen. And Chris Awakens is going to ask for a few air handler units.
Yep.
But they are very expensive pieces of equipment that original install were very inefficient. And Chris just has systematically year after year after year after year after year replaced them. And now we're in a pretty good place. Great long-term planning, great short-term focus, that I think that the next big high return, project is dismantling this old building, and truly investing in new technology. That the challenge with this is it carries a pretty high first dollar economic or fiscal moat. I mean, we stop short of buying the most energy efficient mechanical equipment for the ESSB because it had such a high first dollar hurdle to get over. I think we will try more diligently to get over that first dollar hurdle this time. But it's dollars that, in a fixed dollar world, it's dollars that have to be reallocated. And another challenge is that if the way we make this place work is that you can count on your expenses growing, 5, 6, 7, 8% a year. So you have to grow your revenues at least that. And sometimes that's through new program growth, but frequently it's through new service growth. And when you're investing in air handler units, very necessary, but they don't throw off a whole lot of new revenue. So it is this balancing act, and I think that we've managed it pretty well over the years, with lots of exciting work to come. So. It's great. It's great for Chris to talk about where we're at and his goal to keep us moving forward, and a shout out to his entire crew. So thanks, Chris. Great job, man.
Appreciate you guys. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. That's wonderful.
Bruce has his hand up.
Yeah, one of the things that I think helps us, and Chris knows this probably better than me because it's been many years since I worked in that area, is that because we don't have gas or oil-fired boilers and such being electric, Bonneville Power, when I was with them, they started a thing that was energy efficiency. And anybody who gets electricity from Bonneville Power, so the PUDs, for instance, they have to have in their budgets a certain amount of money that they're going to spend for energy conservation, because Bonneville's not going to build any more dams. And so it's a way for Bonneville to incent them with lower rates to the PUDs, that then the PUDs, and other companies that get electricity from Bonneville Power have to pass on to the customers in rebates for being more electrical efficient. And so that helps us because they help buy the equipment that's more efficient.
And, and Jefferson Healthcare is going to be around a long time, so we may as well become the most sustainable organization we can be. And again, with you guys' vision and Mike's vision, we're going to get there. I don't want to, Mike's right. On the ESSB, we could have done a little better on the equipment. That's probably my 3% that I'm missing, but I'll find it.
I'm sure you will. No doubt.
And you may not be generating revenue, but you are saving us money, Chris.
We are saving money. Yeah. Don't say support services is what we are. We don't generate revenue, but we can save it. So
you got
again,
it.
Appreciate you guys. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Chris. All right. On that high note is another high note, and that's our Chris Harris, our Population Health Engagement Coordinator, is going to report on Black History Month at Jefferson Healthcare. Chris?
Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. You go to the next slide, Brittany. When I first started out on this project, I asked myself, what did I want people to know about Black History Month? So I decided to highlight some of those heroes who were the first at what they did, like the first slide, like Claudette Colvin. Many would not know that she actually sat in and did not give up her seat to a white man 9 months before Rosa Parks did it. Colvin refused by saying, "I paid my fare and it's my constitutional right." But then was arrested by two cops. Later, Colvin became the main witness in the federal lawsuit Browder versus Gale, which ended segregation on public transportation in Alabama. Next slide. Then went to Shirley Chisholm, a pioneer for African-American women holding major roles in government. She first served as educational consultant for New York City's Bureau of Child Welfare and ran for New York State Assembly in 1964. In 1968, Chisholm was selected as first African-American woman to Congress and later became a founder member of the Congressional Black Caucus. In 1972, Chisholm made history once again when she became the first African-American woman of a major political party to run for the Democratic Party's nominee. Next slide. Next, we have Leonidas Harris Berry. Even as a renowned gastroenterologist, Leonidas faced racism in the workplace. In Chicago, Illinois, in 1946, Leonidas was the first Black doctor at Michael Reeves Hospital, where he had to fight for years for an attendant position. In 1963, he was finally named to the attendant staff, where he remained as a senior attending physician for the rest of his career. In the 1950s, Berry chaired a Chicago commission that worked to make hospitals more inclusive for Black physicians and to increase facilities in underserved parts of the city. Next slide. In the 1920s, Garrett Morgan was the first African-American to purchase an automobile in Cleveland. And it was Morgan's experience while driving along the streets of the city that inspired him to invent improvements to the traffic signal. With only an elementary school education, he invented the three-light traffic signal. And this time, Garrett came up with several significant inventions, including improvement to the sewing machine and the gas mask. Next slide. Born Sarah Breedlove to parents who were enslaved, Madam C.J. Walker was the first American woman to become a self-made millionaire. After suffering from scalp ailments that resulted in her own hair loss, Madam invented a line of hair products for African-American women. But not only was she an entrepreneur, she was also a philanthropist who funded scholarships for women at Tuskegee Institute and donated large parts of her wealth to the NAACP, the Black YMCA, and other charities. Last slide. And the last, we have James Cleveland Jesse Owens, an American track and field athlete who confronted fascism with his athletic prowess. Owens was recognized in his lifetime as perhaps the greatest and most famous athlete in track and field history. Time notes that Owens won 4 gold medals at the 1936 Olympic in Berlin, destroying Adolf Hitler's myth about race and Aryan supremacy. Before that, in 1935, at a Big Ten track meet in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Owens set 3 world records and tied another, a feat that has never been equaled and has been called the greatest 45 seconds ever in sports history. That's what I have. Anybody got any questions?
Case?
Yeah, first of all, I'm just blown away by the wonderful posters and displays and stuff you've put up this month. Just really, really remarkable and very, I'm just blown away by how Claudette was age 15 when she did that. I mean, the bravery to do that as a 15-year-old, I mean, just remarkable.
It's so remarkable. It's so many different people that aren't highlighted. So I wanted to dig into some of those people that we don't talk about all the time. So, you know, as the years go, I want to build it up more and showcase more people that we aren't talking about on the regular. We know about Martin Luther King. We know about the Malcolm X's. But do we know about the Claudette Colvins? You know, we don't know about her. We know about Rosa Parks, but we didn't know about her. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think these are the things that we need to push out in the front more. You know, we know about the famous Black heroes, but like, let's talk about those ones that did it for the first time. You know, there's a lot of people that were first time at what they did that we don't talk about.
That's great. I think that's wonderful to shine a light on people who have really made history that we didn't even know it.
I know.
Now we're knowing it.
Now we're knowing it. And we're going to keep pushing forward, and we're going to give out more information about other people. Yeah. Awesome.
So Chris, yeah, I would like to say, yeah, tremendous. I had the opportunity to come in and look at all the displays that you had put together, you and I think maybe Tina. Particularly, I'm so proud as a female to see this young 15-year-old do what she did, and Rosa Parks and the others. I'm particularly impressed with the millionaires, because it takes a lot of guts, resilience, and drive, and there's something special within whoever it is to do these things. So I'm exceptionally delighted to learn about this. The other thing is, too, I also sampled one of the lunches, the themed lunch, which was chicken and grits, fried chicken and grits. So I really appreciate all the work you put into doing those menus from your grandmother or your mother or whoever it was.
Grandmother,
yeah. And I bet she could cook because the food was really good.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And a very nice article in The Leader.
Thank you.
Front page, and just very well deserved.
Thank you, Chris.
That was welcome. It was really educational and inspiring. So
thank you. You're welcome.
Yeah, all right. good job, Chris. I also want to give a shout out to Dunia and Tina Hirschelman, who supported Chris along this as we move this work forward, we have a couple of different goals. One goal certainly is educational, and I don't think Chris could have done a better job of presenting and putting together some of the boards that he did. I found them fascinating as well. But secondly, there's also the work related to what the data is telling us about health equity. We are beginning to get footholds, beginning to collect better data at patient registration so that we can understand if we are providing mammogram rates to all women of our community at the same mammograms to all women in our community at the same rate, for providing colonoscopies to all men and women in our community at the same rate. If our employee racial profile looks the same as the community we live in and we serve racial profile is. So I think that's a long way of saying we're just starting. And I mentioned on several occasions, one of our goals whenever we talk about this work and our commitment to this work is that we are doing it 12 months later. And I couldn't be happier with the progress that we have made, and couldn't be more excited about the progress we'll make in the next year. So great job, Chris.
Thank you.
That's great. Thank you. For that important work, that's key. So thank you all.
You're welcome. Keep working.
Yes. All right, then we will go from there to our patient advocate, Jackie Levin, and her report. Jackie, welcome.
Thank you. First, I just want to acknowledge it's a real privilege to be walking among those great Americans every day that are displayed in our cafeteria. So I just want to thank you. It's an honor. And I hope that at least we could all year round just keep rotating in some different locations in the hospital, some of these displays, rotate all of them through on a regular basis, because it's just something that we should just be aware of every single day. So thank you for that. And to Chris, I want to say thank you as well. Many years ago, just after our new building was put up, the SSB building was up, maybe it was the summer following, I got a call that said, "Why is that fireplace turned on in the summer?" So that was one of our first steps. I just think our community does watch and appreciates those steps. So I just wanted to add that too. All right. Thank you, Brittany. We can go to the next slide. So here we are. We're focusing on our service excellence, and the patient advocates focus mostly on our improve the patient experience in our strategic plan. These are several of the items that are in place for 2022. And just our goal in our patient advocate work is to restore the trust in Jefferson Healthcare and the care that we provide, in that if it was something did not go well, there's trust that was broken. And we hope that through the process we have that it is restored. And I think for the most part, it is. Next slide. And so these are just some of our strategies, just to bring it into our work, along with our mission, vision, and values for the organization with our strategic plan. These are the things that Amy and I strive to do every day, is listen with empathy, investigate the concerns in a timely manner. We follow and report concern trends to directors and other leaders. We work with transparency. I can proudly say that anytime a patient is concerned about the lack, that there might be a lack of transparency in our process, I can say I've been doing this work for 10 years. If this wasn't an organization in which transparency was valued in this process, I would have left 9.5 years ago. So this is a strong point, I think, for the organization, and it's something that's very good for us to be able to share. And we hope that we can also act with kindness and compassion when we're working with our patient staff as well as leaders through the whole process. Next slide. So we're looking back at quarter four, and this is a snapshot of the different issues of the departments where the top issues were. Just in our general feedback summary, it was on average 2.2 days to produce an acknowledgement letter, 14.6 days for days to closure, and we had 5 in the quarter that were greater than 30 days. We've had overall a decrease in the number of what we would call grievance contacts, 67 contacts with 101 items reported. And this is the breakout that you can see with the percentages. And our top opportunities are, you'll see in another slide, provider concerns. And we had COVID-19 protocols concerns, which is no surprise given all the changes that had to be made frequently. Access and transitions of care, and in the communication issue, which is something that I think over the last few months is equal stress on the part of the patients and equal stress on the part of our teams. It's just been, obviously, we all know, a tough time for everyone. And I think we're doing pretty well now, and I appreciate everybody's assistance as we work through patient concerns. So next slide. We're pulling out some of the feedback that we got in our surveys from our emergency department patients. And it's always easy for us, as we know, to focus on what, you know, the concerns that come through, and they're here. We have a mixture of patient responses from, I love Jefferson Healthcare. They treat him as if I was a close friend, or the doctor was a bit harsh in his testing, pushing strongly with his fingers on my groin. And we really greatly appreciate that patients fill out our surveys. I'll be talking just a bit more about that at the end. We have top rated dimensions. This is from our surveys again, that they received the correct treatment, they discussed concerns, providers did, and that there was a consistency between what the physician and the nurse spoke to the patient about. Areas for improvement or pain control, and feeling there is enough time with providers. And as you can see, that we're reaching the green line is, I mean, the yellow line is the NRC average top 25%, and the blue line is Jefferson Healthcare, and we are meeting that line. Next slide. So here we have our issues related to care providers or staff attitude, access, service delivery. And again, as our usual, is care provider issues. We also get a lot. I like to talk about just the navigation calls briefly, that those are ones in which we can make an immediate impact for the patient. And so this is not something that requires a bigger investigation, but can be something where we connect patients with a provider, or connect patients with a director, or connect patients with a clinician to help sort through their immediate problem. We do track these so that we can also still notice trends. And as you know, I'm sure there's been reports in the past on our referral challenges. And so next slide. So there was a big team pulled together and to work on our referrals and transitions of care. And I wasn't on this team, but I can tell you that the work that they're doing will first of all, completely benefit our patients, obviously, but it will also really improve the experience of our staff who receive phone calls to say that the referrals hadn't gone through yet or asking again, where is that referral? And so I think this is really going to make a big difference in patient care, but as well as in staff experience overall and their time. Is Brandy here? I don't know if there's anything she wants to add on this process.
Hi. Yeah. No, you did a great job describing it, Jackie. Thank you. I think the credit really belongs to the team who came together beautifully to kind of drive this work and are still working on it. What you're looking at down at the bottom level there, one of the clinics who was actively participating and one of our frontline staff members was involved in this project from the Port Ludlow Clinic. So what you're looking at in that picture is the number of closed referrals over a period of months, which you can see is improving and has continued to improve. So we definitely still have some work to continue and are looking forward to that, but we're making progress.
May I ask a question quickly? Are these referrals in-house or are they out of area or a combination?
Great question. So the graph at the bottom is actually all referrals. We started the project really focused on in-house referrals first, thinking that we wanted to kind of, that's the majority of our referrals is actually in-house. And we thought, you know, it's easier to control sort of that workflow in that process. So we wanted to start there, hardwire those practices, and then kind of move on to those that go outside the organization.
Okay, next slide. So here we are. This is that we are moving into a new process for our surveys, and every quarter where an NRC picker sends out their surveys to patients, Amy and I get several calls based on either A, I don't remember this visit, it was so long ago, can you look it up for us? And we can. Two, how many pages it is, or its irrelevancy in that they may have seen the provider once and the questions are asking things, as you probably all have received, you know, have you had consistent care from this provider? And they're like, well, I've only seen them once. They were very nice. We also get questions wondering if their particular provider is being singled out. So all these different impressions people have about the survey. And I know that Brandy has also heard some of these concerns. And so we're moving into something that'll be electronic, that will also be many less questions, 10 or so questions, and something that will go out, I'm not sure how quickly, but, you know, in the immediate, you know, sense of when they had their visit. So in this way, we can really also identify more quickly service recovery opportunities. We can track effectiveness of different issues and close the loop more quickly with immediate responses from patients. So I think this will be a great improvement to getting feedback as well as being a recovery kind of process simultaneously. Yes, Kate.
Yeah, I'm delighted to hear that. I've received a number of those questionnaires and they are hard to figure out sometimes how to answer them. You know, when a different provider sees you in the follow-up for a very good reason, you know, it's just very hard to answer those. And I got one of them one week. I filled it out. I sent it in. And the next week, I got another one for the same visit. It's like they hadn't received it yet or something. And so, thank you.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see what the feedback is. Well, yes. Go ahead, Jill.
What about people? Is it all electronic? If people don't have access to computers, how would they be able to answer a survey?
Yeah, that's a great question. Do you have a response there, Brandy, for us?
Yeah, so mainly it would be kind of the way that they have done it, which is connecting with the patient advocate, or they could reach out and send a letter or a note or email any of the leadership team if they wanted to share feedback. It's right now, it's a pilot, and so we're going to try it using this method of text and email combination, but we want to make really sure that we're not losing a great portion of our population. So we're going to keep a close eye on it and hope to connect with our patients and ask how that's working. And we can adjust at any time that that we feel we need to.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, I was wondering how many of our patients use MyChart, and would it be going out in MyChart at any time?
Do you want me to take that one, Jackie?
Yeah.
So we actually surprisingly have one of the highest MyChart utilization rates of any Community Connect hospital, which is awesome. That being said, it doesn't work with MyChart just yet. It would be really cool if it did, but they haven't made that technology work quite yet. So people should still absolutely use MyChart. It's a cool tool, and we're looking for a really awesome ways of expanding that and better connecting patients with their own healthcare. But the surveys themselves won't quite feed in there.
Thanks, Brandy.
Yeah, just I will say that patients are really appreciating their access with the open notes. Maybe you've also taken advantage of that, being able to read what your provider has written about the visit. So that also has been an incredibly supportive patient access to their medical record. So that's it. I think my last slide is questions. We've had a few. Are there any others? Yes, Bruce.
Yeah, I just think that moving ahead with the electronic surveys and things like that, we have to be really careful, because it's like any kind of survey. If you do it a certain way, you have to think about what demographic or what group are we excluding. And if it's, if it's an older group because they don't have technology or don't use technology, or we just have to be concerned about what group are we not including if we go with one way?
Yeah, I'm thinking about the people who aren't signing up for 5G. That's everyone going to lose technology at that point. So we'll see how many people we lose just by that, including me, maybe. Yes, Case, were you going to say something? Okay. Well, thanks, everyone.
Well, thank you, Jackie, and nice report, and we appreciate it. So appreciate your work, and thank you very much.
All right.
Okay. And we'll segue into Brandy Manuel and our Chief Patient Safety Officer for her quality report. Welcome, Brandy.
Thank you. All right. Well, we're going to take a look at our typical agenda. So we'll do a quick overview, and then we're going to focus on medication safety today. And then we will talk about the words of our patients and outpatient surgery. So Jackie just shared some of our ED emergency department data, and we'll also take a look here at outpatient surgery. And then we'll wrap up by taking just a flyover of the big projects that we're working on right now. So a reminder, it's 2022, which means that we have a whole new strategic plan that you guys just looked at. And these are the goals under the quality pillar. So we have four basic areas that we talked about, which is making sure that we're giving our patients their best shot at a great outcome by giving care that is guided by the best evidence. We want to make sure that we have the most effective performance improvement and quality management system available so that our leaders, providers, and staff are all connected with their role in patient safety and quality. And then we want to really make sure that we're embedding a culture of safety, a culture of learning, a culture of reporting, and using all of that together to avoid medical errors. and we also want to continue the work that has been done to transition to value-based care. So a reminder, this is kind of the report that you're accustomed to seeing, and this is the 2021 goals. And we said, gosh, it's the middle of a pandemic. We're going to continue to figure out how to navigate this pandemic. And so we're going to make this much simpler. We're going to add a pillar for COVID. And so we're going to kind of take a simpler look at this, but recognize that this is simpler. So it didn't exactly get smaller, but it captures a lot of the work that we were already starting and really, really important foundational work for our patient safety and quality program. So we're not going to dive into this here because we would be here all night. And as much fun as I know you would have doing that, I'm sure everybody has other things that they would like to get to this evening. But each month we will take a piece of this and we will dive in on different areas. So definitely, if you have any questions about any of these things, please do ask. I'm absolutely happy to answer any questions, but we'll kind of take turns in diving into each one and kind of walking through them as we go month by month. And I do want to also say, you see a lot of yellow and sort of pinkish salmon color here, which we're not accustomed to seeing because we are overachievers and we are always all green or almost always all green. And actually, with a new strategic plan, it's what I would expect. And it's actually really exciting because it means that we are engaging in work where we truly have opportunity to improve. And so I think that as we kind of go through the year, you're going to see those colors flip to yellows and greens throughout the year. But recognize that in some places it's salmon or pink color, just because we're just in the planning phases and we haven't actually implemented the things that we are hoping to implement yet. There's a lot here, so I want to pause and see if there are any questions about that before I go on. All right. So taking a peek, last month we took a look at our core measures and how we were doing there, and we looked at some of our big patient safety dots. And today I wanted to highlight medication safety. So this is one that checks all of the boxes. There are elements of medication safety that are part of value-based care. There are elements that are definitely part of patient safety and our goal to have zero preventable harms. And then there are goals in using technology to improve outcomes. So we're going to talk a little bit about this really incredible team led by Dr. Mattern has been part of it, Dr. Harris, Lanny Turay, and our nursing leadership team. It's been really incredible to see. And it's this amazing collaborative group that comes together once every other month, and they take a look at everything from every medication event that happened to how well we're using technology. So what you see here on the left-hand side is our barcode medication administration. And it's hard to see because it's very, very small. But really the thing to focus on is this blue, it's a dark blue line at the top. And our goal is to be 95% or higher in compliance with our barcode scanning. And this represents the hospital. We're looking at October, November, and December, and the combined score for all three of those was 98.8%. And there's always going to be a little bit of a buffer there because there are always cases where you have emergencies, you have things where the patient needs urgent care, and there may not be the opportunity to get that scanned. So you don't expect 100%. 98.8% is really, really good. And this is one of the best tools that we have to prevent medication errors. So it's great to see our nursing team, our providers using that tool the way that we'd hoped that they would. And I want to give a shout out to our clinical educators. They have been really key in taking this information, working with clinical informatics, and then working with our clinical staff to share feedback about where we have some opportunities for improvement, make sure that they're showing them how the equipment works, and then explaining that if something isn't working because there's a labeling problem or the scanner itself isn't working, rather than just not scanning, really the best thing to do is let us know so we can get better equipment, we can get a scanner that works, and we want to make the system as easy to use as possible. So their role has really been huge. So they're doing a great job with their barcode compliance. One of our big goals last year, and we'll continue this year, is to continue to expand the use of barcode medication administration in our ambulatory clinics and our outpatient sites. So we're doing well hardwiring it in the hospital, and we want to take that to the next level. And then our goal of zero medication events with harm. So we had zero preventable harm related to medications in the fourth quarter. We did have several adverse drug reactions related to COVID vaccines, just a handful of those. And then we had one patient who had an adverse reaction, a medication interaction situation. But otherwise, a lot of near-miss reporting, which is great, and a lot of event reporting, which we want to see because we want to learn from those events. So really good work happening there. They just met yesterday, and their big projects that we'll also be working on this year are replacing our smart pumps, which is another technology used to keep our patients safe and make sure that we're administering the right amount of IV medications. And then really drilling down on our override data. So we want to make sure that we have good systems in place to prevent diversion of medications. And taking a peek at outpatient ambulatory surgery, we don't talk about them very often, but they do really good work and we get great feedback about the services that they provide. And so I wanted to just give a minute to call out how great they do, even with lots of turnover and staffing things and all of sort of the COVID chaos that has ensued over the last year and a half. They just really continue to do a great job stepping up for our patients in every way. So kind of going back to what Jackie showed, it's the same kind of a graph. This represents the overall rating, which means out of a score of 0 to 10, how well do you rate your care at the Outpatient Ambulatory Surgery Center at Jefferson Healthcare? And the only ones that count are the ones that give us a 9 or a 10. So anything less, an 8 doesn't cut it. It doesn't make the list. So what you see here in the blue line is Jefferson Healthcare, and then the yellow line represents the top quartile. And so you can see that, you know, we started just under that goal because that is still our goal, popped up, and we've really stayed right in there with that top quartile performance, which is awesome. And then just a few comments that that put an exclamation mark on the care that is being given. And some 2022 projects and focus areas. We talked about these last time. I am happy to announce that the OB Quality Committee, last time we were talking about kicking off that project. That project is now well underway. Tina is our executive sponsor for that. We have great participation by our providers. Our nurses are actively involved. Again, we've got our clinical educator. So that's going to be a really robust program, and I'm so excited to see the work that comes out of that, working on everything from really drilling into some of our quality measures, and then also looking at things like process improvement efforts, documentation improvement, those kinds of things. So doing it collaboratively as a team, I think, will be really meaningful. Our hip and knee certification work is also ongoing. So our hope is that we achieve one more accreditation under DNV this year. And so our surgical quality committee has been meeting, and Dr. Eisman is our medical director. It's chaired by Laura, and I'm sponsoring that one. And then we've got lots of other things, getting ready for our MIPS reporting. Continuing always to be watching out for infection control and prevention. Our DNV survey for that should be coming up, as well as our annual DNV survey. That will likely be a remote survey this time around because it is kind of an off-cycle year. So they're doing most of those remotely, unless something changes in the next while, which it could. And then just all kinds of other stuff. What questions do you have?
Questions for Brandy? Well, I guess your report was very thorough, Brandy.
Either that or I talked really fast and everybody's sort of thinking, what did she just say? Well, if you do have questions, please do feel free to reach out anytime. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Brandy. Great, great report. Okay, then we'll go right into the financial report by our Chief Financial Officer, Tyler Freeman. Tyler, welcome.
Thanks, and good afternoon. I'm hoping this will be a pretty vanilla financial report, even though we are 10% lower than our expectations. It's not time to hit the panic button yet, and I'll kind of go through some of those stats and why. So on the next slide, we have our operating statistics. So you can see from this, we have quite a few departments where we did not hit our budget. But on the far right column, you can also see that we're, for a lot of them, significantly higher than we were January 2021. So overall, for most departments, we were doing better than we were at this time last year. And there's a few things that, that impacted our volumes in January. One, obviously, being the governor's proclamation that cut down the amount of surgery lines we had, elective procedures going down. Surgery cases is going to have an impact on anesthesiology. It's going to have an impact on pharmacy. There's a lot of downstream revenues that can be impacted when one of these service lines is hit by either a proclamation, a COVID surge that's having us kind of push off some of the procedures that are more elective in nature, and also staffing issues. We did have, you know, some of our own staffing constraints that impacted these. And for the areas, as you go through, and if you looked at the more detailed statistics breakout, all of the departments that you see that were lower than January 2021, that's really the factor that's hitting them. It was either governor's proclamation or short-staffed, and so not able to provide the procedures that folks needed. And then we also had the snowstorm, if everyone remembers. So that kind of hit a little bit of volumes in some areas as well, when patients weren't as willing to travel for those elective procedures. So if you go to the next slide, we have the income statement summary. So as I said, 10% lower gross patient service revenue than budget, but actually 6% higher than January of 2021. So we are at a higher run rate than we were 2021, but lower than our expectations. Revenue adjustments are down in line with gross patient service revenue, which is what we'd expect. And then that other revenue number is $275,000 higher than what we budgeted. And as you recall, when we received the ARP rural funds back in November, we made the decision, since we had through December of 2022 to utilize those funds, and we hadn't earmarked them yet for how we had used them. And it's a use it or lose it type deal. If we don't use the $3 million, we will have to pay that back. We made the decision to recognize for the next 14 months. We have a little over $200,000 worth of other revenue that's going to be rolling throughout the entirety of 2022. And then the other reason not to hit the panic button is our expenses were also down. So we expected to have a ramp up in staffing and in the amount of procedures that we were doing, but that didn't come to fruition in January. We're still working on that, but that has led us to lower salaries and wages, lower employee benefits, lower supplies, and other things that you would expect to be lower when you're not cranking out as much volume as you expected. We still did have higher than expected professional fees and purchase services, and those are to be expected as well with the staffing issues that we're still having to deal with. But overall, $500,000 of net income, 4.4% margin. Both of those things are definitely a good start to the year for being 10% lower in gross revenue. And then on the next slide, we have the cash and accounts receivable. And it's I wanted to include another day's cash line that just included our estimate, just because makes it a little bit more sense for why, when we moved all the way up to 158 days cash on hand, why some of that was not, we didn't expect to keep it. And so it can lead you, if you're not including that Medicare payback that you're expecting to have to do, it can lead you to make decisions that you wouldn't have otherwise had. If you're thinking you have $3 million more than what you really do, you can make different decisions. And so including that estimated payback to Medicare is an important thing to keep in mind. And so we added that, included it in the analysis. So now the top yellow line is our total days cash with the Medicare advance payment that's been paid back. About 50% of that has been paid back now. Then we have the, I don't know what you'd call that, pink salmon line that's in between. That's our actual cash. It's just the dollars that we have in the bank account as of today. And then the green line underneath that is the dollars that we have in the bank minus what we expect to pay out, either through advance payments or through reconciliation process with Medicare. And then the next slide has the report. One thing I did want to point out that you I'm sure noticed is the $14,000 worth of other purchase services. That's related to the Jefferson County elections. We have to pay, it's a portioned out between all the districts. So that's for the November 2nd general election. That's our portion of that expense. But other than that, nothing to really note for the board financial report. And then February is on the next slide, and it is looking pretty similar to how we started in January. We still are not quite full, sprint yet. So we're still at 90% budget, still 10% lower. We're hoping those numbers start to change. And then our cash collections have been down. The other thing that I didn't mention, but I mentioned last time, was we at the end of the year when we knew we had to pay Medicare back, we tried to do that in one swoop, and instead they did not take our payment, and so they've been withholding the claims. They've started paying us again, but that definitely has impacted our cash collections. So cash being $40,000 per day lower than what our goal is makes sense in the fact that there was a portion of the month where we were not receiving any money from Medicare. But other than that, we're in pretty good shape given the circumstances of how 2021 started off. The other piece to budgeting is we always kind of expect the beginning of the year to be a little bit lower than expectations, because when we do the budget, we smooth it out over each of the 12 months. And obviously that's, there's a little bit of seasonality. There's seasonality with some of our expenses. Utilities look like they're above budget this month, which, I don't know. If you give it in Chris's report and you saw that number, you're probably thinking, well, that doesn't make any sense, but it's a 12-month thing. And obviously all of our utilities were much higher in January than they will be in July here. So it's kind of expected, and not adjusting for seasonality is what leads to some of these budget variances. Any questions?
Questions of the board?
Yeah, Mari?
Yes, I was wondering, so we stopped being paid by Medicare, and they just, I guess, deducting those monies from the money they sent us, and then they started paying us again. Is there any rhyme or reason for that, or what's the scoop?
It's what they're trying to do is it's based on our cost report, and so there can be some pretty significant swings, which is why it's important to estimate that in your day's cash on hand. Because what they're doing is they're taking last year's cost per visit for all of our visits and saying, this is going to remain flat. We'll pay you exactly the same. Well, in a year like 2020, that can mean that your cost structure now is where it looks like you need to be reimbursed a lot more. And so then they overcorrect. And then 2021, where it's the opposite, we're getting paid more on a daily basis, but at the end of the year, we're going to have to settle up because we've got a little bit more volumes. And so they're trying to, they don't have any adjustment factors. It's just based on the previous years. So it's all outdated data. So we know that there's always going to be a settlement either in our favor or back to CMS at the end of the year, just given our volumes. And typically they will take the check that you try and send them, and it'll just be in one payment. It's kind of like getting your taxes done. There's a you finish the Medicare cost report, they'll say you either have a refund due to you or more to go to CMS, and you'll either get paid or you'll pay them. And in this case, they did not take our payment for some reason, and instead just took it out of our claims for the next month and some change.
Tyler, is there
so it's all balance out then, basically.
Sorry, what was that?
So it's fairly balanced. It's sort of settled out now.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the year, we'll get paid. Eventually, when all the dust settles, we will get paid for our portion of costs.
Great. Thank you.
Tyler, is there also withholding going on for the advanced payment distribution of a year ago?
That when they ceased paying us because of the settlement that said that we owed them $3 million, they also ceased recouping on the withhold. So the Medicare advance payment didn't have any movement in that time period.
We expect that to resume.
Yep, that's already kicking back up. So now that we're getting our claims paid, there's also the deduction on our claims for the Medicare advance payback.
So that's a great point that there are some hospitals that are experiencing significant financial stress right now, and a likely cause for that is that they were in a difficult financial spot 18 months ago or so, took the advanced Medicare advanced payment, and unlike what Tyler has done, where we sort of have a cash line that includes the advance payment and then a healthy cash line that doesn't, they just have one line. And if you had to spend the CMS or the Medicare advance payment to fund yesterday's operations, then you are going to be in serious trouble when Medicare starts to withhold reimbursement for you today and tomorrow to pay that back. And I think we're seeing that in a couple of vulnerable hospitals that are suffering the consequences of that. And it can be pretty punishing when you deliver the care, you have the expenses associated with that care. But in Medicare's eyes, they've already paid you for that, so they aren't going to pay you for it again. And we're beginning to see that across the state a little bit.
Do you have a complicated process, Medicare, Medicaid, from CMS? It's just amazing case. You have a question?
Mike, do you happen to know how Olympic Medical Center is faring with all of that?
Yeah, I think they're hanging in there. They were in a really strong cash position going into this, so they're hanging in there. They're pretty smart operators over there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tyler.
Thank you very much, Tyler, for you make it easy to understand a very complicated process. Thank you.
Thank you.
But don't ask us to repeat what you said tomorrow.
Yes, as long as there's no test at the end, right?
Yeah, I'll work on a quiz next time.
All right.
All right. Thank you, Tyler.
Thanks.
Bruce, will you please speak up? Because something has happened to the film strip along the bottom of my screen, and it apparently, unless somebody speaks, the picture goes away and you become one of the numbers at the end.
Oh, I'm here.
Okay.
I was going to ask some questions to Tyler, but he answered my questions in his report, so.
Okay, there you are. Okay, thank you.
Great, that's what I always hope to do.
Yeah, well, you did a great job.
All right, then we will move on to our Chief Executive Officer, Mike Glenn, for your administration report. Thank you, Mike. Welcome, of course.
All right, welcome. Next slide, please. So the volumes, and this is, it's always a good sign when this line trends down. These are calls into the COVID hotline. It's popped up a little bit this last week, but you know, 40 to 50 is much better than, you know, 150, 160, which we were experiencing about a month ago. And I think this is a real good indicator of disease prevalence and community prevalence and community anxiety, because both probably warrant a call to this line. Next slide, please. These are the primary care and specialty care volumes hanging in there around 90% for the last couple of weeks. All sorts of challenges since Christmas, when, you know, when Omicron roared through the country and Washington State. Probably the biggest challenge is that it was so much more transmissible, and we didn't experience much more of that within the hospital, but we sure saw it out in the community. And we sort of jokingly made the observation that I bet if you follow the data, it would be deemed true, that the hospital was a pretty safe place to be if you wanted to avoid Omicron, as compared to buses or locker rooms of middle school or high school athletic events. And so often there would be an outbreak associated with an activity like that that would then infect the entire household. And we probably saw more family members of Jefferson Healthcare employees impacted that way than we did taking care of COVID positive patients. So when there's a big uptick in community prevalence, and, you know, just to give you some perspective, there were some months where we had one month where we had just one positive the entire month, and certainly you know, a couple a day was the standard. We had one day where we had 70 positives just come through Jefferson Healthcare, and lots of days where there were 37, 40, 45 positives running through our testing systems. So it was, you know, by a scale of 4 or 5 to tenfold more community prevalence than we've ever seen before. So it was a real challenge keeping staff well to come to work, because if, you know, that we had very conservative protocols, and that if you were exposed and didn't have a booster shot but just experienced an exposure, we kept you away from work for 3, 5, 7 days, and a couple of negative antigen tests. So I think the good news is that we really did a good job of keeping our patients and our employees while they were at work safe. The challenging news is it touched a lot of people. And I think the entire, all of the directors and managers at Jefferson Healthcare deserve accolades for keeping their teams together, keeping the staff intact, and just taking care of patients during these real challenging times. And it's not uncommon probably to see a little downtick in volumes because of that. Next slide, please.
If I might add, a next door neighbor just got COVID-19 and probably picked it up in the emergency room over in Mount Vernon. So I think kudos for what our
Thanks.
Staff here does in terms of the protocols.
Yikes. Volumes in our cancer care program and surgery, you'll see cancer care bouncing back as it always does, and surgical cases down in large part due to the governor's moratorium on elective cases. And we expect those to come bouncing back. Next slide, please. This is the ED and the Express Clinic volumes. Both are, are back down to a more manageable level. I think it's always a good proxy for all kinds of disease prevalence in the community. These volumes in these two clinics are, in talking with the players down there, while we still see pretty intensive spikes and in the emergency department aggravated by long lengths of stays while we attempt to find specialty care for a patient, it's certainly seemingly more manageable than it was, in the other COVID spike periods. And we've also moved to a two provider trigger. If we project volumes to reach a certain point, and sometimes it's just the day of the week, we will go ahead and bring a second provider in the emergency department or a second provider in the Express Clinic, and that helps to manage patient flow and take care of patients more timely and more orderly, or in the case of having two or three boarding patients in the emergency department, which has happened, it just makes that a little bit more manageable. Next slide. I wanted to talk a little bit about advocacy and the work we are doing. This is a busy time for us. So the issues that we are most focused on are probably the staffing bill and the charity care bill. And with respect to the staffing bill, House Bill 1868, it's really important for us to say we are for safe staffing. We are also for a safe work environment, and we are for community access to care. What we are against is House Bill 1868. We think that the ratio bill focuses on the right problem, but this is the wrong solution. So because of that, and many of you have been involved in discussions, we continue to challenge the legislature for better solutions. And we think the best initial solution is just working on the nurse and healthcare worker employee pipeline. That I think significant investments over the next couple of decades will be required in order to catch up on just what we need for today's age demographics in our state and country. And we all know where that is going. So we are continuing to do that. We're continuing to work with our legislative delegation to try to find answers to what everybody is feeling. Everybody that has wears a Jefferson Healthcare badge has been feeling tired and burnout and overwhelmed. So we are engaged with Representatives Chapman and Theringer and Senator Vanduatti to come up with answers that will fix that problem, but not at the expense of access to care.
Mike, there was a short piece in the Seattle Times a couple of days ago from the nursing, someone in top of the nursing in Virginia Mason, I believe. And it was very well written and I think explained it very well, just like Dunya's letter did. how this is going to be so detrimental to the patients in Washington State. So I'm glad we're working still and trying to keep that going to make things a lot better. And the nursing pipeline and the staff pipeline is the way to go.
Who wrote that article, Mari?
Well, I don't have it here with me, but I'll get it to you and I'll email you with it.
It was like it's just a nursing officer of Virginia Mason in downtown Seattle. I think what's important to note is that, our response to House Bill 1868 isn't just it's not no in pushing back at the work conditions of all healthcare workers can't be improved. It's no, this is not the right solution. So when we interact with our legislative delegation and when we interact with Washington State Hospital Association, it's always, well, let's propose this. Here's a solution that we think will begin to address some of the concerns pointed out in the bill, but do it in a community responsible way. So it continues to be an important problem to solve. We just think the solution is complex and probably not doesn't come in a one size fits all way.
Mike, at one point you had said something about that there are perhaps some bad apples that have really sort of been the driver behind this. And I wonder if WSHA has tried to deal with that in some way.
Well, I don't know. What I can say is that we sort of view our staffing from the perspective of the current law, and the current law requires a staffing committee to come together that's represented 50% by bedside caregivers and 50% administration, and they are charged with coming up with a staffing plan. And if that group, which is 50-50, can't agree on what a staffing plan is, and that's basically sort of the loose ratio guidelines, then it comes to the administrator, and the administrator, it's like the vice president in the Senate that the CEO of all hospitals has the up or down vote. I'm proud of the work Tina and our bedside caregivers have done year after year after year. That's never occurred here. Every year, the staffing committee agrees to a staffing plan that is supported at the committee. I know that's not the case in every hospital across the state. And I think these are difficult issues. There's no question about it. But I think it all starts with mutual respect, good communication, and sincere and genuine interest in finding solutions that work for all parties. And I'm pleased with the work that we have done up to this point and look forward to continuing that.
Great. That's very helpful. Thank you.
The next issue is charity care, and we haven't been following this real closely or talking with you about it, mostly because the revised charity care requirements, and this is a bill that's being pushed by the Attorney General's office, are either at or even less generous than where we are at. So the net impact of Jefferson Healthcare would not be significant. But for a while, the concern was that, and initially it was, I think the bill came out with free care for anybody and everybody who is at 300% or below the federal poverty level. And in a whole bunch of rural communities, that level exceeded median income for that community. So if you think about the, you know, the economics of a public or a critical access hospital, which are, you know, are you see in most of those small rural communities, that we get paid below our costs for Medicare and Medicaid, and that's, you know, 78% of our business, and then above our costs, if we do a good job contracting with our insurance companies for commercial insurance, and then the charity care patients that we have. Well, if presumably the folks who the median income in a community represents those folks who are working and who have insurance. Well, if they learn that because their income is below that level, they don't need to continue buying insurance, that could really be crushing for a small rural hospital. And a handful of hospitals did the work to show them that even a $400,000 swing could be the difference of losing a little bit of money or losing a lot. WISHA did a good job negotiating with the Attorney General's office on hospitals' behalf, and they came up with this tiered system where larger systems have a higher charity care bar than smaller rural hospitals. That negotiation continues. And we will keep you up to speed on it. Tyler has been involved and actually provided some really good information, you know, about what's included in that analysis of eligibility for charity care. But we don't think it's going to impact Jefferson Healthcare, mostly because of where we started in the first place. But it's an issue that's getting a lot of attention in Olympia. And lastly, I wanted to comment on the supplemental budgets that were just released by the House and the Senate, and kind of where big chunks of money related to healthcare were issued. Lots of money in both budgets for healthcare workforce education and pipeline. So $5 million in the House budget for nursing education, $13 million to purchase simulation lab equipment. And why that makes sense and is related to increasing the pipeline is that so much of a big part of every nursing student's education is being on the floor, and on the floor is in a clinical setting, monitoring care, watching care, or in some cases providing care while being monitored. There's a fixed amount of those opportunities in many communities, and even in larger communities, and frequently more nursing students than available opportunities. So there are lab simulation devices now that do a great job of simulating a big portion of that bedside care. Not all of it, but a big portion of it. So the thinking is that if we make investments in the nursing schools, introduce and install these nurse simulation laboratories in nursing schools like Peninsula and Olympic College, that we can increase the number of students that are enrolled each year or each cohort because you no longer have that rate limiting factor of where is the clinical experience going to be. So we talked about this in a call probably 6 or 9 months ago And it was the nursing program said this would really be a helpful thing. So I was thrilled to see that much money actually allocated in the House budget for that purpose. A bunch of money for difficult to discharge patients, about $400 to $600 million to help create access. And that's in assisted living centers, group homes, nursing homes, all of the discharge sites for patients that that our case managers are trying to place. Yeah, when I first started doing this, it was the exception that a patient would go anywhere else other than home when they were through seeking their care. There were certainly the patients that would go to nursing homes, but it just seemed like the vast majority of patients discharged from the hospital would go directly home. Now, due to a bunch of complicating reasons, it's not nearly that way. And any given day, we probably have 3 to 5 patients, you know, which represents 20% of our 20 to 25% of our total patient population that have complicated discharge stories that no family in the community or no family in the community that can take care of them, limited means, limited support systems, and it's the hospital's responsibility and obligation to not discharge the patient until we secure a safe and nurturing discharge site. So one good thing about the pandemic is that it shined a bright light on the lack of availability of those sites. And when you're full and have really sick patients that need to come in and be taken care of, and limited amount of employees to take care of them, getting patients out quickly is crucial for our ability to continue to take care of our community. So we were working on this, WSHA was working on this. When I say we, hospital administrators all across the state, chief nursing officers all across the state, case managers all across the state, engaging with legislators and saying, you have to fix this. And $600 million is a pretty good start. And then $50 to $100 million to create access to for behavioral health patients. And, you know, this is if you get the Seattle Times, you likely saw an article, I think it was maybe Sunday and Monday, you know, criticizing hospitals for taking care of behavioral, and it's frequently adolescent behavioral health patients, in many cases been ITA'd in the hospital emergency department. And I can tell you, I have been involved in meetings where every emergency department doctors, the chief medical officers, the house supervisors, everybody is furious at they are in the emergency department because it's not because it's a great place to seek care. It's just better than anywhere else. Our Shannon in case management making hundreds of calls as far away as a Spokane. Looking for a bed. And then when you find a bed, there's like a 6-hour window where it's available, and arranging transportation is a challenge. Everybody involved in that system recognizes that it's broken. It's a little bit frustrating for the hospital to be hospital emergency departments to be fingered as the problem when it's folks like Dr. Smith and the ED nursing staff and the ED technicians and all the support system around them taking care of a severely ill and in crisis 14-year-old in some cases. It's as sad as it is frustrating. And I suspect $100 million is a drop in the bucket compared to what's necessary. But it's, again, it's a start. Next slide. Dunia and I continue to pound on the Critical Access Hospital Modernization Act, and Tammy Tarsa, if we pass this act, Critical Access Hospitals could actually meet the needs of their community pre and post acute, and not get financially punished by doing so. I know of a couple of critical access hospitals right now that have skilled nursing facilities and are hemorrhaging because of the financial disincentives for a critical access hospital to do it. And in these cases, they're the only SNF beds in the community. I mean, they truly could be at this place where they have to decide, what do they give up? They give up the nursing home or the hospital. I mean, that's how goofy some of the original stipulations of the critical access hospital law are. Nearly everybody we talk to believes philosophically and conceptually comma is much needed, but they get cold feet when they begin to understand the financial, the fiscal note attached to the need that expanding critical access hospital eligible services would bring about. But we're re-engaged with Kilmer's office, we're re-engaged with Senators Murray and Cantwell's office, and we'll continue to pound away. And then we continue to do work with our consultant, Jake Johnston, looking for funding for the hospital replacement project. And I think I may have mentioned in an earlier meeting, lots of interest and funding availability to introduce new community important services like radiation oncology, in addition to infrastructure needed in hospital replacement projects. So we're meeting on a monthly basis with Jake, and he's bringing to our attention different grant opportunities and funding opportunities, and we are trying to align that work with the work related to finding other funding for the new hospital project.
Is that federal or?
Well, it's both, but federal is the work Jake is doing is mostly at the federal level. When we began our discussions with the legislative delegation, we said we talked with them about the project, that it's going to likely be starting in 2023. And that we would be coming back to them in the starting of the full session in January of 2023 with our hat in hand and hand sticking out. And you know, it's not uncommon for the legislature to allocate millions of dollars for a project like this one. So we're going to make it hard for them to say no to us. Next slide. And just a handful of some other work that's going on. There is life post a pandemic, and we're starting to gear up for that. Our operational improvement work begins with our organizational culture work. So we've engaged the Huron Group. We've assembled a leadership team. It's this great team of SLG members and other leaders in the organization, split off to an accountability team who's actually going to be doing the work to put together some of the evaluation instruments that come along with this, and some of the other tools that will help all of us become more accountable to our work and to each other. And then another team, the LDI team, the Leadership Development Institute team, which is the team that's responsible for putting together those quarterly educational events. They're basically a retreat with much more structure. And we were shooting for the first quarter of this year for the first LDI, but with what we've just gone through and some of the other initiatives that are going through the house, we are starting off maybe a little bit more deliberative with this work than we would have in other years. But that work is ongoing, and I'm looking forward to that flywheel beginning to turn. The federal government made available to all rural health clinics, and you know, we've got a bunch of them, pallets of COVID test kits. And when we first learned of this, it was like, late January, early February. So we were going right on, right about the time, you know, the community, you could not find one of these things, or you might find one on eBay for $100. We thought we were going to get like 5,500 of them. Well, the shipment got delayed until about a week ago. And then boom, the pallets arrived. And we have a bunch of these kits. So we decided that the smartest thing to do with the first bolus is to get them out to our workforce. Because as long as there is disease in the community, our workforce will be exposed to it. And we think by allowing our team to do access to quick and easy antigen tests, that will help keep them and their families safe. So we have given two kits or four tests to every Jefferson Healthcare employee. And Alyssa's been managing that. And I think we're about 80% of the way through with that initiative. And we have reached out to Dave at DEM and some of our other public health partners and community partners, because we think we will continue to have access to these pallets of tests because of our rural health clinic status. And we plan to provide a pipeline of tests to these other agencies, and they will act as the test distribution system. Would have been awesome. This were 3 weeks ago or so, but I don't think that Omicron's going completely away, and access to test, I think, will continue to be a thing. So we're happy to play that pass through role. And then lastly, Tyler spoke of the governor's proclamation, which placed a moratorium on elective surgery procedures. Well, that's ended. All surgical procedures are now allowed. How we managed it was we typically run three surgical lines on most days, and we reduced that to one line, which worked fine when it did, but what frequently happened is that there were add-ons to that line, so it made it a very long day for Donica's team. And then there would be emergency cases in the middle of the night, which would make it a very long evening for Donica's team. So it really was it was a difficult go for her team these last 30 days, and I think by opening up these additional lines, it will take some of the pressure off. So the drill now is, and I think Dr. Mattern is going to speak to this a little bit more in depth, is and this goes house wide, but the focal point right now is in surgery, is focusing on balancing the needs of patient demand, and it's considerable. I think in every surgical specialty, there are, you know, long lists of patients that require surgical procedures in the queue with just staff fatigue and capacity. So we're going to be very mindful about how we balance that and make sure we are meeting the needs of patients, but not at the expense of placing harsh demands on employees. So that concludes my presentation, and Dr. Mattern is at the ready to slide into the COVID update.
Thank you, Mike. That was very in-depth and thorough report. Thank
Great.
You.
Dr. Well, Mattern. I'll jump in. I'll talk mostly COVID with a few other things. But you know, first and foremost, as I usually kind of start off with, just talking a little bit about the current state with COVID, particularly in our community. So I think everyone's pretty well aware that the overall prevalence of COVID is going down in our community across the state and across the country, actually across the world. Actually, we're seeing some COVID decline. People are certainly mentally turning off or kind of tuning out to COVID sooner than the actual prevalence has gotten down. I think it's important to still remember that we have over 2,000 people a day still dying in this country from this disease. So as you're seeing, you know, the conversation has clearly shifted to, you know, turning back public health measures and moving past Omicron. But this is still a pretty significant disease that's still impacting communities and families across this country. Again, we've been successful in Jefferson County and this is the real key, right? Decoupling hospitalization and severe illness from COVID infection. And so we've seen numbers obviously through the Omicron surge we've never seen before in this community. But thankfully it has not translated into a overwhelming number of hospitalizations and severe illness, particularly when you look at the risk demographic for our community. And again, that has to do with a high vaccination rate, first and foremost. And as we see, you know, still over 2,000 people dying, who's in that group? It's people who are unvaccinated or people who are vaccinated and not boosted, particularly individuals with significant underlying health problems. So older and frailer are the folks who are still going to continue to be at risk as we move forward and COVID becomes more endemic. Again, vaccination is what also protects those individuals. The fewer infections around, that's what makes it safer for the more fragile members of your community. We're seeing the cases come down. The health department had 42 cases over about a 3 to 4 day period, and then 15 reported today. And I think that's about what we're kind of starting to see, is that you're seeing about a 10 to 15 daily case rate. That probably would have come down lower. Those numbers would be lower for Jefferson County, if not for a few things. It's important to understand that Jefferson County includes reported home positive tests. Not all counties will take antigen tests or home test results take them into account in their numbers. We do. There is a outbreak at a residential facility that the health department has been working with that has also kept the numbers up. And the Super Bowl, I think, we had always kind of thought about bumps in cases after Thanksgiving and Christmas and, you know, the winter holidays. Did not think, maybe it was the teams that were playing that didn't have it on our radar, but sure enough, we had a number of positives that came out of actually Super Bowl parties. We've had, you know, kind of a couple cases in the hospital kind of at any one time, generally, you know, again, hopefully as the numbers come down, you see the impacts on our hospital rates improve, but also improvements on our staffing, right? So as the community rates go down, again, that helps because we don't have people who have kids who have positive results that they need to stay home with, or they don't get breakthrough infections from exposures in their, particularly in their family and personal life. So that is the good news. At the same time as the cases are coming down, so we are seeing some of these things that we needed 1 to 2 months ago. So testing access, you know, particularly the at-home tests, would have been nice to have the pallets to have arrived in early January or late December, but they didn't. But to Mike's point, they still have a role moving forward. And first thing is, again, being that we are a critical infrastructure you know, institution, and the fact that we work with high-risk folks, we thought having easy test access for our employees was first and foremost. And so as our health officer has kind of pointed out, COVID tests should be a little bit like having Tylenol and a thermometer in your medicine cabinet at this point. The disease is going to be around. We know that it can still cause significant harm to individuals who are not vaccinated or individuals who have other health conditions. And so we still want people to have easy access for testing and identifying their infections. So we're starting with the test distribution, and then we'll start to begin to think about, as Mike mentioned, what community partners. The health department has been reaching out to some of the local daycares to see if we can get some test supplies, either through the health department or supplemented through us, so that, again, you can begin to do the surveillance in those high-risk scenarios. And then I think moving more towards point-of-care testing, you know, it's never in a flu season did you ever have test kits that were out for people to self-test. That was something that has developed with the pandemic, and that's probably not something that will be, you know, kind of sustaining moving forward. And at some point, moving the tests into the clinic so that testing looks more like what happens for strep throat or influenza, which is people having visits and possibly having rapid tests at the time of a primary care visit or urgent care visit, and moving away from the maybe the self-testing PCR. So we're going to talk about that, but that's all going to be sort of the shift that we see. The other thing is, you know, kind of better late than never, therapeutics. The antivirals, we're still seeing a short supply in those. There was documentation on the state website that Paxlovid was available at our institution in Don's. We call them Don's Pharmacy. They're wondering where their Paxlovid is because they never received any. So I guess it fell off the back of the truck somewhere. But Paxlovid is still, which has been the most, the evidence will show has been the most effective antiviral. We've gotten some limited supply, which we've been using and we've been distributing out for patients who have the right risk criteria. So we've been rolling that out a bit more, and more people have had access to the antivirals. We've been using some monoclonal antibody in the emergency department, as well as some protocols for pregnant women to do outpatient infusions using our birth center. So we have some protocols in place. I think that supplies of those treatments will continue to expand, probably at a time that the infections are running lower. But again, those are things that we are going to have to be well versed in. So right now we have a few primary care providers who are prescribing the antivirals. Eventually that should be look a lot like Tamiflu, which is that any primary care provider or other even, you know, kind of some of our specialty providers or emergency department express clinics, everyone should feel comfortable prescribing those medications as we move forward. Other things to know, vaccination, you know, really demand across the country has plateaued. There is new approval for new COVID vaccine being sought from Sanofi, I think, that is a more traditional vaccine. So maybe there will be some interest because it's going to look more like, from a mechanism, vaccines that people feel more familiar with and not the mRNA vaccine. So if that gets approved and is available, then maybe there will be some more uptake in the United States. But at this point, in the U.S., vaccinations have really plateaued. And with case rates going down, not sure we're going to see another bump. So some of these new vaccines that may get approval may be more important for better vaccination globally. I'm not sure how much we're going to kind of see more as far as uptake, which is a shame too with regard to boosters, because we do see that booster vaccines, particularly for Omicron, not just the BA1 variant, which is what started, but there's now the BA2 variant of Omicron, which has outcompeting the first variant, but generally is behaving very similarly and is also very much neutralized by people who and people who have had the primary vaccine series as well as a booster dose. So where that's folks who have had a full vaccine series and booster, those folks are, when faced with Omicron, are not ending up with severe illness, not ending up hospitalized. And so it's very protective. So that's the main thing. You know, we're preparing to see mitigation and social, you know, measures roll back through the state, vaccine admission for restaurants or mask mandates. We know these things are rolling back in the next month. It's going to take some education and emphasis again with the community to understand that healthcare facilities are different. We are not the same for what the workers have to do, who we come into contact with, the density of, the population density of medically fragile individuals within these walls is different than what it is when you go to the Silverwater Cafe. So we have different standards that we need to keep people safe here. And so masks will stay in effect. Having said that, we do need to, as the case rates come down, begin to open up certain programming, particularly programming that relies on groups. So support groups and rehabilitation classes. And so we have some initial planning that hopefully in mid-March we'll be turning on some of those programs that we've been doing purely virtual, and hope to get people gathered again, because it is an important part of the care. If you're part of the persistent pain pathway and you're relying on some of these group sessions to help you manage your pain, and that makes you less reliant on opioid medication, or if you're planning for a hip and you need to be prepared and understand your rehabilitation prior to having a surgery so to get the best outcome. So pulmonary rehab, cardiac rehab, these are the kinds of programs that we need to get back. And group components can be a really important part of the care experience. And so as we kind of pull back on, we see the prevalence come down and some measures get pulled back, we're hopefully going to get people back together. But again, we will anticipate that they will need to be masked, and we will still continue some of the measures within our own facility that you'll see no longer mandated out in the community. And so, it's probably a good kind of, I just want to emphasize a bit of what Mike was touching on the end, which is that, I think it's important for the board, again, because you are a liaison with the community, and I know you get asked about things, is to understand that how healthcare is different. So, that we do have this, I'm always keen on the term polarity management, which is that, so much of what we have to do oftentimes is trying to find an equilibrium between forces that are in, opposition and at tension with one another. And this is the tension we're going to find, is that there's pent up healthcare demand again after 2 years. I think we have something like 160 surgical procedures that are expected to, try to get done to, that's the backlog. And at the same time, we have a staff that is extended, and exhausted. And so the idea of flip the switch and let's get them all done and we'll run the OR for 24/7 is not an appropriate strategy. So so it's going to take some patience from the community. Then we might have the patient who's saying, I've waited this long for my you know, to get my knee surgery done. And, you know, the governor's mandate went away mid February. Why do I have to wait till April? And the reason is because we need to do things pretty intentionally. So I think the plan with surgery is a great one, which is for the next few weeks, we're getting surgical lines back up. But the time that the teams finish is sooner than we normally would, you know, pre-COVID. And that is intended to reduce the number of hours that people have to stay or that call teams have to be pulled in, because those teams are tired and we need to reduce the excessive burden on them. So we're going to have this balancing act, and I think we can look at other areas. We could look at primary care. We've put off some preventive visits, health maintenance exams, and the such, and we're going to have a backlog of those. But at the same time, we need to recognize that staff has been stretched, and so we can't just simply say, well, let's just sort of double book those into other visits and think that we can kind of power through and not have a cost to that. So this will be, you know, such an important thing as we move forward. And you probably are seeing the statistics about the percentage of healthcare workers that are thinking that maybe they don't want to be in healthcare in the next, you know, 1 to 2 years about leaving. And that's at all levels, physicians, nurses, advanced clinicians, techs. People are really, they're tired and they're wondering if this is the way forward. So, as we talk about our strategic plan and we really start talking again about the next 3-year strategic plan, the people part, and in particular wellness of our employees, wellness of our clinicians, has to be a big part of it, and we have to be very mindful of this balancing act. So when you're out in the community, if you hear kind of mumbling or frustration that maybe things have been moved and things aren't kind of coming on faster, I hope that you are able to relay the challenge that we have of this balancing act. And we'll try and do obviously the best that we can, but we definitely have to be mindful moving forward. Lastly, I'll kind of just give you sort of tying into that, you know, some things kind of coming out of COVID. So as we, you know, move past this surge and hopefully, you know, there's not another, you know, huge surge in the future, you know, no new variants that we're dealing with. You know, we're beginning to lift our head up and start to do some of that work that every time we try to do, we get kind of knocked back down again. But we're hoping this time it's going to stick. Some of that is around clinician wellness. I know you often in the past were part of some of the provider engagement events and educational things that we did in social events. So we're beginning to kind of talk about those again. We've actually collected new data on clinician satisfaction, particularly specifically burnout. We did the Maslach survey again, which is something we did a couple years again. So we're beginning to compile that data, as well as we did some specific satisfaction data around the electronic health record and use as a tool. We did not just physician and advanced practice clinician surveying, but we also did allied health providers and nurses. So we have some information there that I think we can do some really interesting targeted work in the next year. We've already got some clinical informatics projects. We want to roll out or expand single sign-on with a plan to move that into the specialty clinics. That's been particularly helpful in some of the outpatient settings to cut down on typing and sign-in. We're continuing to look at an artificial intelligence documentation software product that Providence is trialing and we've looked at. And so we're kind of letting that get fine-tuned. Clinical informatics is improving their at-the-elbow support. So there's some really interesting things that are happening. But I think actually the thing that folks are missing most is actually the socialization and the connection. And so I think when we get to the point where we can feel better about bringing people together again for educational events and getting people connected in larger groups again. That's part of what builds resiliency, particularly among your medical staff. And so we're beginning to think about sort of what that can look like once we can get to the point where the COVID prevalence is down. Some other things that are, interesting that also is important as part of our strategic plan, which is, we've been contacted by a few specialty providers that we don't currently have in the community, either interested in employment or interested in collaboration. And so it's kind of fun to be thinking again about services that our community needs. We have a few recruitment opportunities for primary care and some onboarding of some new providers in different areas also through the year. But I think there's a, continued opportunity for bringing services into the community and reducing the need to travel out. Space is the key thing again. So as we're kind of talking about that master site plan, it's one of the things that holds us back and makes us say, wow, we've got a clinician who might want to be in the community or come up here from a different facility a couple times a month, but do we have a place to put them? So we're going to have some conversations with folks and kind of talk about what opportunities might look like. All the more reason that it is good that we are looking at that strategic plan and particularly space expansion, because it may be one of the things that holds us back. We haven't had a lot of turnover with our medical staff, which is, I'll knock on some wood. I think we're really fortunate that way. And I think we've got a really good alignment with mission with our medical staff. And I think we've got a good culture amongst our medical staff. So I think we're a place where there's a shakeup for where people want to be and what they want from their medical careers. So I think we can be a landing spot, but we may need more space to be that landing spot for some folks. So some of the work ahead for us. But I'll stop there and let you fire away any questions that you might have.
Any questions of Dr. Mattern? Wow, that's a lot going on.
No, just a thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Case, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, a quick question about the severity of COVID for patients who are hospitalized. I'm wondering, do you have some figure as to how many of them actually end up on respirators versus are in for monitoring of low oxygen saturation levels, or what the primary reason is for their hospitalization and not being able to get care at home?
Yeah, I think we're still, once people get really, really sick with COVID, they can certainly end up on a ventilator. We've seen less critical care utilization now. Is that partly because in this wave we have a larger number of folks who are vaccinated or have maybe previously been exposed to the virus or combination? So I think you are seeing, we certainly have had some folks in our own hospital who are still requiring high flow and potentially needing ventilation, but probably not to the same degree. Some of the hospital numbers, again, there was certainly a higher number of patients who were admitted to hospitals for other reasons who were found on their COVID screening on admission because, again, hospitals do that partly to place these patients in the right unit so that they're not infecting, anyone else. So the patient who, came in and really for all intents and purposes, maybe they had a fall and a broken hip and they weren't feeling, poorly, but they weren't having low oxygen levels. They might have screened positive for COVID. In fact, some of those patients, because they haven't met the criteria for severe COVID, have sometimes received actually the monoclonal antibody to prevent them from possibly proceeding to severe COVID. They were treated more like an outpatient for their COVID, but their inpatient reason was for their, broken hip or another medical a problem. So definitely, I think the take home is particularly for an unvaccinated person, and I think this has been the, part of the confusion from the public, right? They said, oh, it's milder, Omicron's milder. Well, the truth is Omicron for an unvaccinated individual is actually more severe than the original version of COVID. So it's less severe than Delta, yes, but still more severe than the original variant. So, but it's hard to kind of, kind of separate out because there's so many of these other factors. But I think when you look at kind of the data that's published around differences in hospitalization mortality based on unvaccinated compared to vaccinated but not boosted, and compared to boosted, and particularly when you age adjust, the differences in some of those data sets can be as much as 20 times the risk of death, 20 times the risk of severe illness and ICU admission, purely between the difference of whether you're vaccinated or not, particularly whether you're boosted or not. Does that help?
No, I was just curious if we have people on ventilators.
Not as many, but we have transferred out, I think, a couple through the Omicron wave, certainly. You know, the other thing, too, I will kind of, and this is also the sort of our future state. You know, we had a general medical staff meeting, and one of my pitches to everyone was that we're getting to the point where we're going to decentralize our COVID response, right? So you've had the medical officers who've been the COVID physicians, and we've been, you know, tried to be the source of expertise locally for our medical staff, you know, whether it's the emergency department or the hospitalists or the outpatient clinicians. At some point, we have to decentralize, and we have to understand that COVID infection, treating someone who's acutely infected because the disease will continue to circulate, but also what we are beginning to appreciate and is quite concerning, which is the after effects of COVID. So there's long COVID, and actually I've asked Junia, she and I have kind of talked, because they're beginning to talk in state circles about what our community is going to need, and a lot of times long COVID comes up, which is the ongoing fatigue and brain fog and some of the other symptoms like that extends past the initial COVID infection. And so, beginning to calculate what do we think that prevalence is going to be in our community. Again, luckily, because of vaccinated and fewer people with severe illness, you get less long COVID. But there's another part of post-COVID, which is COVID sequelae, which is different than long COVID. And what I mean by that is, one of the things I talked to medical staff about was a study out of the VA data set, looking at what was your risk for cardiac events 1 to 2 years after you had COVID infection. These aren't necessarily people who have long COVID symptoms. And everything was higher. Even if you had mild infection, you had a higher risk of a heart attack, heart failure, a stroke, being diagnosed with cerebrovascular disease, other vascular events. Everything was higher. Myocarditis, heart inflammation for sure, much higher. The more severe your COVID, the more likely that you were going to have a higher risk of an event 1 to 2 years later, a cardiovascular, cerebrovascular event. And what we don't know is that risk forever? Is that risk dynamic? Is that going to be worse? So is that risk, if you're twice as likely to have a cardiac event 1 to 2 years later, is that risk going to be four times more likely 5 years from now? Or is it going to be like quitting smoking? Will that risk kind of come back down to baseline the further out? And we don't know. We know that we're finding COVID virus in brain tissue. Well, what does that mean for, are we going to see neurologic things 5 to 10 years from now? What's going to be the rate of diabetes? Because we know that after severe COVID and ICU admission, that your risk of diabetes is higher. Is that going to be something? And you start magnifying numbers of those risks over large population, you could be looking at pretty significant chronic diseases that you're dealing with at a higher frequency for folks who had infection. And so particularly for your primary care clinicians who are your front line to chronic disease management, my push for them is you got to start, if you're going to a conference this year and there are options to learn about, what do we know about COVID and COVID sequelae and long COVID, you should be going to those lectures. You should be seeking out that education, because this is something that we'll be looking to bring educational opportunities, but this is something you're going to have to get comfortable with moving forward. And so better sooner than later.
Thank you.
Anything else? That's a lot to think about, Dr. Matter.
Yeah, sorry, I should have ended on a cheerier note than that, right? We are kind of, you know, did I mention the case rates were going down? Okay, well, we'll end on that. Yeah, there we go.
And that we have a master plan.
Yes, exactly. There's good stuff. Good stuff. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Matter. All right. And, we will go on to our board business. And we didn't thank Mike properly for his report. Thank you, Mike. That was, you know, a lot of great information in your admin report, too. I don't know if everybody have a chance to ask Mike any questions you might have about that. Okay, then we'll go on to board business, and the first item under there is the Board of Health. Case, you sent out a very nice report, I see, to the board. Do you want to talk about it?
All I want to mention is that the Board of Health passed the proposal for us to become the oversight entity for the Community Health Improvement Plan. So I just want to mention that. That's a very positive step, and to acknowledge that Jefferson Healthcare is contributing $25,000 to that effort in order to help pay for that, because it obviously benefits our patients and our mission as well for the health of the community. Just also say that we had an excellent presentation by the Nurse Family Partnership people. I didn't realize that Jefferson County was the first to have this Nurse Family Partnership 20 years ago. We were the first in the state of Washington. And it's just a remarkable program that nurses provide to families of young children. And that's pretty much all that I have to report. If I've sent the complete packet to everyone, if you're interested in more details, you can find it there.
Thank you, Case. And just to clarify, the resolution that was passed made the Board of Health responsible.
Yes, when I said we, this is the Board of Health. Right, correct. And then speaking of public health, I do want to just say that a real hero, a remarkable figure in the field of public health, unfortunately died earlier this week, Dr. Paul Farmer, who as a medical student started a clinic in Haiti, and out of that grew the preeminent source of healthcare to much of the underserved world. His organization was called Partners in Health. And if ever we needed more people like Paul Farmer, we need them now in order to deal with the health inequity in the world. And he died inexplicably at age 62. While he was in Rwanda, his favorite place to help provide health care. So just a word of condolence to his family and to the world, really. It's a huge loss.
That's sad. That's too bad. Okay, thank you. Mari?
Yes, this is for Case. The nursing shortage, it was an opinion, letter in the opinion on Sunday's Seattle Times D2, February the 20th, and it's regarding the nursing shortage, reject one size fits all approach. And the person who wrote it was Alison Bradywood, DMP, MPH, RN, NEABC, Vice President, Chief Nursing Officer, Virginia Mason, Franciscan Health. And it's a short note, but it's well laid out.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. I thank my husband for bringing me the paper.
So is there any other board business?
The evaluation, that's about it.
I do have one other bit of board business, if I might. Are we going to put on the agenda the discussion of the board being involved in donations to the community. This was something that we were going to put at the retreat. We didn't have time to cover it. And I think that we said that we were going to put it on a future agenda, but the retreat was very recently. So if I could please ask you, Jill, to put that on our agenda for next week. And we might need some information from Tyler about the amount of money that Jefferson Healthcare provides to the community, to organizations like Rotary and elsewhere. So if you could include that, please.
We decided that we would put it in our regenerative government meeting. So yes, it's planned for that.
Great.
Okay, and then if there's nothing else, I would like to say something to Mike Glenn. We've had some glowing reports today, and people doing extraordinary work. And Mike, a lot of that is due to you, and your ability to choose the people who are so stellar and work with them and help them be the best that they can be. And that starts with you at the top. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Jill.
I agree with that.
I do too.
Thank you.
It's unanimous. Yeah. All right, then let's go on with the meeting evaluation. Case, you're in the upper left-hand corner. You want to start?
Well, just an amazing amount of information, a lot of stuff to cover. Yeah, I wish we could figure out some way to have more discussion, but so be it. Okay. It was a good meeting.
Bruce?
I mean, great reports. I mean, I don't know where to start. I mean, I'm looking forward to delving more into Brandy's new metrics, you know, her graphs and stuff that she has. You know, the Black history. I mean, there's so much that's left out of our history books, you know, that when we were growing up that should have been covered but wasn't. So, I mean, that's all really good stuff that we get another glimpse into some things that we might not have ever known about. Dr. Mattern's report, you know, lots of good things. You know, we've got masks and we're able to restart a lot of things, you know, whether it's around surgery or other services that we've had to kind of put on hold, and people have had to put on hold getting services. And Mike's report about what's going on with the legislature and all the different things that are happening there that hopefully will impact us in good ways.
Great.
Don't hold your breath.
Mari?
Yes, I do agree with my colleagues, and there's not much else to say. Just an incredible amount of information, and a lot of it very positive and some a little challenging, but I think the entity, Jefferson Healthcare, is up to it. And I'm still concerned, very concerned about the staff. They are exhausted. They are fed up. They've just been stellar all these months. And I just hope with maybe better weather and longer days, it'll bring a little more of a respite for them to enjoy the environment and get out a little bit without getting infected, and rejuvenate them a little for, you know, because it's a long slog, and I respect them all so much. And it is a tough life when you look at how caring for other people and doing it to the best of your ability takes a toll. So thank you to all of them.
I hope the weather holds for their staff barbecue this Friday. Chris is offering a barbecue. So.
Oh, and I didn't comment about his, I think I did briefly, but the fried chicken and grits was really good on Friday.
Well, I echo everybody's comments, and I also say, hey, 97% on the energy yes. rating is a huge step in the right direction too. So lots of really good things going on, and about darn time. So thank you, everybody. And with that, may I have a motion to conclude the meeting?
So moved.
So moved.
Okay, moved and Mari seconded. Is there discussion? Yeah. All right, everybody raise their hand if you'd like the meeting to be concluded.
All right.
Still for now. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.
Take care. Stay warm.
Yeah.